Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, First Mate Sidekick, and with me, as always, is Captain Spike.
You best start believing in ghost stories, Miss Turner. You're in one!
Well done. Today is November 30th, 2013, and this is episode 42B, Ghetto Daze, a GameBuoy spotlight on Pokemon. Welcome once again, dear listeners out there in Radioland, to the second half of this week's episode. Today we're going to be talking about one of the biggest jewels in Nintendo's crown with the wildly successful Pokemon franchise. Now, 15 years ago, Pokemon Red and Blue hit North American shores and started a multimedia sensation. And with October's release of Pokemon X and Y, we here on SS Game Buoy have been feeling the Pokemania come back with a vengeance. So we figured what better time to look back at this series and see how it's evolved over the years, no pun intended. We hope you enjoy the discussion.
SB, stop evolving!
We hope you enjoy our discussion and, you know, maybe that you'll learn a few new things as well. Before we talk about the games themselves, I'd like to start out just by taking a brief look at the history of Game Freak, which is, of course, the company responsible for the mainline Pokemon games.
You're super freaky.
People who aren't intimately familiar with Game Freak or the Pokemon franchise might not realize that it actually started out as a gaming zine. This, of course, was the combination of Satoshi Tajiri-san and Ken Sugimori-san, who are still, you know, part of the company today, very important. Tajiri-san was the writer, and Sugimori-san was the artist, still is the artist. All the Pokemon official art you see is done by him, and I believe
The vast, vast majority, some of the X and Y official designs were actually not by him.
Oh, really?
Including stuff like a Dual Blade, for example, and its family.
Oh, interesting. See, I didn't quite realize that, so he just dropped some truth bombs on me. So, one thing that is actually interesting is that in 1986, Tajiri-san did design work on The Legend of Zelda, and because of his work, Miyamoto-san was actually impressed and kind of offered to mentor him. So that was something that I, you know, back in the day had no idea there was that connection there. In 1989, Tajiri-san and Sugimori-san started the company Game Freak, the gaming company, which, you know, is still thriving today. But, you know, before the Pokemon series, though, I don't think they really had any huge Smash successes. Some games that you might be familiar with are Mendel Palace from 1989, Smart Ball in 1991. The one that maybe you're most familiar with is Yoshi, the puzzle game from 1991, and then also Pulse Man in 1994. Do you have any experiences to share about these early Game Freak games?
You know, I may have mentioned being a huge fan previously of Pulse Man. Mm-hmm. You know, in particular, Pulse Man has a weird history, you see, because in the U.S. it wasn't officially released except for via the Sega Channel. And I have discussed here on the show, you know, that I was a Sega Channel subscriber. So I played Pulse Man, and I loved it, just could not get enough of it. Of course, as an addendum, Pulse Man was released worldwide on the Wii via Virtual Console, if you want to go back and take a look. I definitely think it's worthwhile. But when Pokemon was sort of up and coming, I remember EGM discussing the Pulse Man connection, and so I was immediately very interested. I hadn't been following Game Freak as a studio yet for the obvious reason that, you know, I mean, who's looking at something like Yoshi or Mendel's Palace and being like, I want to follow these guys. But definitely when EGM, and it must have been EGM because they were the only mag at the time that was really focused on both the U.S. side and the Japanese side. As soon as they had pegged Pokemon as coming from, you know, the people that made Pulse Man, I was all in and I joined in the Pokemania hype very early as a result.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this before, and you were really, really early adopter. So let's talk about Pokemon. The idea originated as Capsule Monsters in 1990. Jiri-san saw a Game Boy and thought, you know, the link cable could be used to communicate between the games. And one of his childhood loves was collecting bugs, of course, you know, kind of similar to the way that Miyamoto-san loved to go out and explore in the wilderness and stuff, and that inspired Zelda and such. So, similarly, that's what sparked this idea in Tajiri-san's head. And kind of the history leading up to the release of the first games is interesting, because we think of Pokemon as this huge financial multimedia success, but, you know, the development process took about 6 years, and there were lots of hardships. A lot of employees quit. Tajiri-san worked a lot on the game without pay, so kind of similar to a Mega Man 2 situation there. Game Freak was nearly bankrupt, and they needed an investment from Creatures Inc., who, you know, still involved with the games today, to help finish these games. So, kind of a very interesting history, a very modest history in a lot of ways.
Are you going to talk about the weirdness of translating the games for the U.S. yet, or is that something that you're going to talk about in a moment? Because you're talking about the game development of the original games.
Well, actually, now we're going to be launching into our discussion proper, and the way we're going to do this is just kind of look through each generation and see how the games grew, and, you know, what new side games were involved, maybe share a couple anecdotes.
Well, I have a thing from the development perspective that something that I find absolutely fascinating is that, you know, as a result of their troubled development, the original two, Red and Green in Japan, you know, they were, their source code was so horribly, poorly put together.
Right.
That they couldn't actually be brought to the U.S. You know, a lot has been
exactly.
said about how, originally, you know, we got Red and Blue, and they were based off the Japanese Blue version. And that's because, Red and Green were both so poorly programmed and so poorly put together that making any real changes to any of the variables in the code basically tore the entire system down, and it just fell apart completely. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation that this is sort of related to why, even in, you know, the version that was released here based on Japanese Blue, why there are so many easy ways that you can sort of glitch out the game code, because it's still, even the improved version is still itself somewhat shoddily put together.
Right. So, as you mentioned, Red and Green were the first games. Pocket Monsters Red and Green came out in February of 1996 for the Game Boy in Japan. And, you know, most people who are familiar with Pokemon at this point to, you know, a certain degree are probably familiar with the fact that these games were Red and Green, initially, not Red and Blue as we knew them. You know, I can't say I know why they chose it Red and Blue for America, but, you know, and like you said, it was very fragile. You know, I didn't realize it was so fragile. I imported it. You know, after I got into the American games, obviously, I was not as early of an adopter as you, but...
Yeah,
even
my
though,
very
even
first
green...
import game of all time was a Pokemon game.
Oh, really? Well, I guess that's true for me as well, but, you know, for Pokemon Green, even though I recognized that it was basically Pokemon Blue, I just kind of wanted it for bragging rights, I guess, and to be like, hey, I don't even know how to read Japanese, but I know how to play Pokemon, so, hey. You know, if you are familiar with the original Pocket Monsters Red and Green, the sprites were a lot more primitive looking, and so, you know, some of the Pokemon designs, you know, in game really don't quite look like what we know them to be today. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to look back on that. Did you ever import Red or Green from Japan?
No, I imported Yellow.
Ah, all right. Ah, Yellow's such a great game, which we will be talking about very soon. So, you know, you also mentioned Pocket Monsters Blue, which came out in October of 96 in Japan. So a couple months later, my understanding was that this was like a mail-order-only game. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, which game?
For Pocket Monsters Blue in Japan. That it was like a mail-order-only...
It was originally, I believe they opened it up to general retail release. I want to say that the mail-order one was like in 98, and then maybe the... retail release was in like 2000. Like, there was like a gap of more than a year for sure.
Oh, interesting. And like you kind of alluded to, this was more of the basis for our Red and Blue that we later got.
I actually just looked it up. It was a mail order special edition only to subscribers of Korokoro. And that was in 96. And then the retail version was released in 99.
All right. Okay. I didn't realize there was a retail version. And it's interesting you mentioned Korokoro, who, you know, still enjoys a healthy relationship with Pokemon to this day. So, you know, the sprites that are from Blue, I believe they're identical. I don't think that there were any alterations made, but...
From
Blue, Pocket Monsters Blue to our Red and Blue.
Oh, no, in that case, that's true. It did have changes between...
Red and green, definitely.
I mean,
the Pokemon that we think of, and, you know, and even if you think back to the original Red and Blue, you know, they were redone for Yellow as well, which we'll talk about. So, I mean, I really identify my memories with the Yellow sprites, but we'll get to it in a little bit.
I've actually still never played all the way through Yellow because I had an import copy of Yellow. I did not double dip on an English copy of Yellow.
Huh.
I had not, you know, in my youth, I had not expected that we would ever see Yellow come out here, which is why I had imported it as soon as it came out in Japan in September of 98.
I have a funny similar story for a later generation.
We didn't get it released here until more than a year later in October of 99. And I had thought for sure that it would never come out here. I did not expect Pokemon to be the giant that it was. So I went ahead and pulled trigger on a pre-order, on an import. And I really liked it, but since I had already done the whole Pokemon Master, collecting 150 Pokemon and getting a little certificate at the end, I had sort of had my fill for the time. And so my copy of Pokemon Yellow was really something just to have nice sitting on a shelf.
Interesting. So, you know, they did fix up the source code a little bit in Pocket Monsters Blue, but the release of Pokemon Red and Blue, you notice now that I'm saying Pokemon and not Pocket Monsters, the games to this day are still called Pocket Monsters in Japan, which, I mean, most people probably know that, but, you know, we only know just Pokemon. And a lot of people, you know, who aren't super familiar with the franchise might not realize that, you know, this is a entirely separate game from Red and Green or even Blue. It's not that they just localized it. They had to, you know, rebuild it from scratch, even from Blue, because Blue still wasn't, you know, stable enough to, you know, meet the Nintendo of America standards, I suppose. So, you know, they couldn't just translate it and such. They had to reprogram it from scratch. And, you know, they did take the artwork from Pocket Monsters Blue, but they kept the monster distribution different from Red and Green. And that was something that, you know, and we'll kind of talk about it a little more in the Pokemon Red and Blue context, because I think for most of the listeners out there, including you and I, most of us probably, even though, you know, essentially the same game is what we identify with more. So, you know, these are the games that kind of started it all for those of us in the West, maybe with the exception of you, if you had been aware of it earlier. So, 15th anniversary back in the end of September for Red and Blue in North America and Europe.
Happy Pokeversary.
Right? One thing that's actually, you know, I say in North America, Europe didn't get it for over a year. And, you know, this was a trend that would kind of last throughout up until, you know, the worldwide release of X and Y. So, Red and Blue, give me a few quick anecdotes that you have.
About Red and Blue?
About Red and Blue. Red and Blue, which one was your first version?
Oh, man. You know, I actually, to this day, have only ever owned Red. I never owned Blue.
I can see that. You're a Charizard fan.
You know, the funny thing is, my very first Pokemon playthrough was with a Squirtle that I named Squirty.
Aww.
So, I appreciate, as an idea, that, you know, I'm certainly very into Charizard now, because he's a giant, cool-ass dragon. But... No, I was all about my Charizard, and I, you know, started up a Pokemon club in my high school.
That's right.
We played at lunch every day. Well, yeah, I mean, I needed to...
You were like a senior in high school at this point, weren't you?
I was, I think. I think this was my junior year. I want to say this is like 98, 99, not 99, 2000.
See, now this is where our age difference makes a little bit of difference. I was also, you know, older than the, you know, target range for the marketing, but... I was in 8th grade, so I was in middle school.
Yeah, and we definitely, I mean, we did get a little bit of side-eyeing that we were playing, you know, Pokemon at high school, but, you know, to be a Pokemon master was my destiny. I had to get 150 Pokemon, I had to have a complete Pokedex, and the only way that was going to happen was by networking, so I seriously took it upon myself to start up a club to meet every other day in one of the teachers' rooms in high school, and... That's how I got 150 Pokemon.
Do you have any yearbooks that say the Pokemon Club?
I don't. We were not, like...
An officially sanctioned club.
We were
club.
Not, like, an officially sanctioned club. But we were, like, a thing, you know, for an entire year where if you were playing Pokemon and you were at that school, you came into that room at least a few times.
Oh, wow. Now, I remember some of my friends at the time. I was kind of starting to make some new friends, you know. I was getting towards high school age, kind of drifting away from some of the friends I had grown up with who were kind of, you know, just going through that stupid teenage boy thing. And, you know, I started to get to know some friends who were into, like, anime and stuff. But that didn't quite happen during Red and Blue. So I kind of remember Red and Blue being around and being like, oh, Pokemon. But, you know, I was too busy playing, like, Ocarina of Time and N64 stuff. And so I actually did not have Pokemon Red and Blue first. So I can't even really remember who I chose. I do remember that after I got into Pokemon with Yellow, I asked for Red and Blue for Christmas, played through both of them. I think I probably chose Charmander and Squirtle, rather. And, you know, even though there's, you know, the whole idea of gotta catch them all, and, you know, you can do that mostly with one game and trade with friends, you know, I kind of just took it upon myself to trade with myself. I had a Game Boy Color eventually. I used my sister. Before I got my Game Boy Color, I was using my sister's Game Boy to trade with myself, which is kind of a little bit sad, actually. And, you know, a lot of people are kind of like, oh, I'm the type of person who would just, you know, raise a team, and then if I want to raise more Pokemon, I'll just do it. But I was really, at that time, into the idea of, like, oh, no, I want each distinct team on each game, and I want, you know, each game to kind of have its own set of Pokemon. So, I don't know. That was just kind of my thing, like, oh, I'm going to use a Cloyster on this team, but I'm going to use a Dewgong on the other team. And then, on top of that, I also got used copies of Red and Blue later on, because I wanted to raise other teams, but actually the used copies I kind of used as my Game Genie, Game Shark ones, because I didn't care that it would mess up the Hall of Fame and stuff, so, you know, I'm not proud to admit it, but, you know, that's how I got my Mew and stuff, but like I said, this was actually after I got into the series through Yellow. So when we talk about Yellow in a few minutes, I'll kind of share my initial experience with that. You have any other anecdotes from Red and Blue?
You know, I used mystery number glitches to get Mew.
I'm sorry, do you mean missing number?
Missing number, sorry, yeah. This was, of course, you know, the technique where you would go into the Safari Zone and surf on, like, ground tiles.
See, the only time I ever used missing number was on the coast of Cinnabar Island for the item duplication. I had not been aware of the Mew glitch until much, much later.
Yeah, I don't even remember how we found it out, because this was contemporaneous with Pokemon Club at high school and stuff. This was early days. I don't even remember how gaming rumors and tips used to spread, because, you know, there was not internet resources like there is now, but, you know, it was a big deal for me when I finally got my number 151 in my Pokédex, even though I did certainly get it through illicit means. You know, I was a big fan of the Pokémon First movie. I stayed in the Pokémon fandom all that time, and when that movie came out and I saw Mew, like, everyone else was, like, freaking out about Marill and all of, like, Snubbull and all of these new generation Pokemon that you saw in the Pikachu Summer Adventure featurette. But I was all about Mew. I had to have a Mew. And so when I got one via this glitch, it was like, oh, thank God I have this damn thing. It's like a little space cat.
Right, and the whole origin of Mew, and I'm not talking about, like, the origin of Mew, but in a game...
No, but you literally just said the origin of Mew.
But in a gameplay's perspective is that there was, like... My understanding was there was, like, seriously, like, one little bit of data that was left. And so Tajiri-san programmed in Mew as an Easter egg, and, you know, never expecting anyone to find it, but, you know, people somehow did, and then, you know, then they eventually started officially...
Distribution events.
Distributing Mew. Did you ever have an official distribution Mew?
You know, I didn't. There was one year that Amanda, whom we discuss here on the show, and she'll be on the show at some point, she and I went to Toys R Us to try and get Muse. And this would have been in early days, years before I ever met you, but they actually ran out.
Well, the funny thing is we have a story in yes, a later generation.
That's why I was pointing out that this was a thing that has happened to me multiple times.
So when we get to
times.
Generations 3, we have a story to share.
What about you? Did you ever have an official Mew?
No, never.
I'm hoping that there's some sort of official Mew event in X and Y, because to finally have an official Mew would be basically like a life goal.
I agree. I mean, especially with Pokemon... Pokemon Bank coming, but we'll save that for the end. So, yeah, you know, Red and Blue at the time, I remember this being contemporaneously released with the first season of the anime, and I remember the anime was syndicated before Kids WB picked it up. Do you remember that? I think it was on UPN out here.
Yes.
Channel 44 yes. for us.
Yes.
So, I remember... I actually watched the anime before I got the games, so that was kind of interesting. Because I had started getting into anime myself, actually. Sailor Moon was my first anime, but this is not Anime Buoy. Because I was 14 at this time, I wasn't really paying attention to, you know, like, gaming sales trends, but you were a little older, maybe more in tune with this sort of thing. Do you remember the reception at the time and how quickly it exploded?
And for which game is this?
For Red and Blue. Cause
I remember, and I just want to make sure, I remember very distinctly, and I probably will always remember, that first week or couple of weeks, you could easily go to the store and get these games. I had a lot of friends who actually bought Game Boys just so that they could jump in with us, because we were all so interested in it, sort of me and my sort of little core two or three friends. And everybody from, like, Space Pirate Ben's mom, even.
Wow.
Like, these people started buying Game Boys to get into these games. And I do remember there being, like, it was a little dodgy, that first few weeks to month, where it was like, oh, is this really going to take off? But the next thing I knew, everyone I knew who was a gamer had these games. And the few that didn't were, like, looking forward to the next, like, birthday or Christmas or whatever to get it.
See, that's really interesting, because Pokemon and, you know, before that, Magic Gathering and anime in general, DBZ, Sailor Moon, was kind of... Well, I mean, it was also maybe because I was in middle school, and middle schoolers are just brutal, but it was very uncool to like Pokemon, so I kind of always felt like it was my little secret. Actually, I have an anecdote for the first movie when we talk about Yellow.
And it's funny that you say that and that you bring all of these things up, because certainly to me, and I, you know, there was a lot of nerds in my school, very fortunately, but I felt like there was almost like this perfect circle where, you know, there was like a Magic the Gathering club, which I often attended. There was an anime club and, you know, obviously this Pokemon club, and the ranks of all of these clubs really sort of really swelled at this same year, where it was like this perfect storm of like these really nerdy interests becoming very popular in that age group for a couple of years. And so it sort of all coalesced and sort of fed into each other, I think, this sort of collectible competition game of like, you know, collectible card games, and, you know, the anime connection. I really think all of these fed into Pokemon and its popularity at that time in, you know, 98, did we say it was for the US?
98, 99, that era. Yeah, and I'm really glad that you're touching on some of this stuff, because when we talk about kind of the larger media franchise, I mean, you'll have a lot of great insights to that too, having been a little bit older. And, you know, it's funny, I know that we're spending a lot of time just on Red and Blue, but, you know, I'm kind of just thinking now, it wasn't until I met you and, you know, our group of friends now that I really didn't feel embarrassed to, you know, talk about Pokemon. And, you know, now I'll post about Pokemon on Facebook and everything and tweet about it. But, I mean, even up through college, you know, I didn't want to be like, oh, yeah, I play Pokemon.
And, you know, the weird thing to me about that is I don't think this is just a my group of friends thing. When I look online, even on major forums like, you know, NeoGAF, Like, you look on Gaff, and there's, when Pokemon XY came out, there was one day where basically the entire first page of Threads was Pokemon Threads. Like, mm-hmm. this is a major event. These games are a major event in
yes.
gaming, not just among little super dirty subclicks like you might think or expect with a game like, let's just, as an example, say Shin Megami Tensei Soul Hackers, where, you know, 20 people are really passionate about that and no one else gives a fuck. Like, no, these Pokemon games, I mean, they do tens of millions of units. Mm-hmm. They're big deals.
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it just might be, for me, my experience growing up as a gamer. So, I mean, and that's something for another episode or a micro or a...
I'm sorry, what would be?
I'm just talking about me growing up as a gamer and as a gamer, but this isn't Game Buoy NPR, although we could do, like, a Game Buoy Advance, which could be, like, a little NPR.
Girl, you better watch out. I'm about to start writing up a show roll for a Game Buoy Advance.
All right. Well,
a more mature look at at Game Buoy topics.
Oh, you mean so no more poop and fart episodes?
Pretty much.
Well, anyway, so Pokemon Red and Blue, you know, like you said, quickly was a very, very popular thing, and, you know, in Japan as well. So, you know, the roots right here for it being a worldwide sensation. Before we talk about Yellow, which is where I have a little more to say, I want to talk about Pocket Monster Stadium, which is a Japan-only release in N64. And you're like, hey, wait, Stadium came out here. But, again, those of you who are a little more familiar with the Pokemon franchise might be aware that this was the original Stadium. It only had about 42 Pokemon available. It was actually a lot more difficult. It was not a plug your Game Boy cart into it. I'll talk about that when we talk about Stadium, a.k.a. Stadium 2.
Stadium as we know it.
Right, right. One thing that's easy to forget is that HAL Laboratory worked on it, Pocket Monster Stadium, and the other Stadium titles, as we'll get to. Did you ever play Pocket Monster Stadium? I remember knowing about it, and knowing that our stadium was Japanese Stadium 2, but...
Yeah, I was extremely familiar with it, because, you know, this same window of time was when I was really into studying Japanese, and so I was reading a lot of Japanese resources on the web. So I was very familiar with it. It was something I was considering importing, because this was also in the time of my life where I was going to anime conventions really regularly, importing a lot of games there. So I actually came very close to importing this first Stadium, and I'm very happy that I didn't, for reasons that you probably want to discuss.
Yeah, just that in the context of the later Stadium, which we'll talk about very soon, that it's just, it kind of feels incomplete. So, yeah. Anything else to say about Pocket Monster Stadium? This was August of 98 in Japan, so... Kind of just as we were gearing up, you know, Pocket Monsters was already underway in Japan for 2 years at that point.
Well, something that's always struck me as funny is that you hear a lot of people talk about how Pokemon has never had a presence on the in the console space. But I actually think the exact opposite is true. I've always, you know, for as long as I can remember looking back, even, again, as we're talking about here back in 1998, there's always been console representation of Pokemon.
Just not mainline games.
Just not... what we think of as quote-unquote mainline games.
And, you know, before we talk about Yellow, I really think that's an interesting point, is that I feel like gaming culture at large, and correct me if you feel that this isn't the perception you get, but kind of view console games as mainline games. So, like Mario mainline games, Zelda mainline games are the console ones, and that the, you know, portable releases are kind of like second tier. I always feel like there's kind of that attitude, but... So, for me, at the time, seeing that Pokemon was primarily designed, and, you know, for design reasons, was made as a portable game, was kind of a different sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, again, the real birth of... Or I should say, like, sort of the confluence of influences that resulted in the birth of Pokemon... One of the core tenets was the very idea of using a handheld game to link with another handheld game. So, really, the whole portable lineage and sort of being a series primarily on portable, like that, it's baked in a very literal way into this game's DNA. Mm-hmm. Like, the concept of the game is based on being on a portable console.
Right.
But, to me, the interesting side note that I was trying to make was, while that is true, and I suspect will always be true, Nintendo and, you know, Pokemon Company and HAL and etc., all of the studios they typically work with for these console spin-offs, they have always been willing to experiment in that console space and bring
indeed
these experiences and these characters to that space in, to me, some oftentimes really interesting ways, which, you know, we'll talk about Gale of Darkness a little later, yes. So I won't get into it right now.
And then also some very not-so-stellar ways. Poke Park.
Well, again, you know, it's easy to look to thumb your nose at Poke Park, but it's basically it's basically the starting point, like the germ of an idea for what we're getting in Poke Bank. So I don't think Poke Park is all bad.
I think we might be thinking about different things.
Oh, I might be thinking of Pokemon Farm or whatever.
Yeah.
Which one was Poke Park again?
Poke Park is a mini games game that we'll talk about in the modern era of Pokemon. anyway, so Pokemon Yellow came out in 1998 in September 98 in Japan, October 99 here in North America. And
shit, yeah, I wasn't thinking of Pokemon.
It's all right. And June of 2000 in Europe. So, a couple of the changes from Pokemon Yellow is that there were a couple story changes based on the anime. It was really trying to line up more with the anime. There were fights with Jesse and James from Team Rocket. You get Pikachu as a starter, and your rival gets an Eevee, just like Gary and Ash. Pikachu follows you around. You can talk to him. And then there was, you know, I remember a lot of the kind of promotional things. There was Pikachu with Surf, the Surfing Pikachu, and that unlocked the Surfing Pikachu minigame.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the Pikachu VW Beetle that, like, did a tour of malls or whatever. I never saw it, but, so I remember a lot of this stuff because that was the first Pokemon game I owned. And, I have a lot of strong memories associated with Pokemon Yellow. You know, it was the first time that, you know, I joined in, kind of with my friends. And this was also right after my birthday, so I remember being like, you know, just get me... I assume they had gift cards back then, right? For games?
Yeah, yeah.
EB games and stuff?
Yeah, or digital stuff, or, you know, whatever your local gaming store was. We didn't have a GameStop here at that point. I don't even think we had a Funko Land.
Really?
We had, like, mom and pops, basically, in this area.
Well, I mean, for me, this would require going a half hour out of town.
Yeah.
For where I was growing up. But still, you know, so I think I was like, you know, all I want is some money. I mean, I might have just asked for money or something so I can buy Pokemon Yellow in a few weeks. And I just was so into it. I'd get home from school. I'd, watch the Pokemon anime, and I think that was on when I was still in school, so I had it, like, set up to tape on my VCR. I'd do that.
Yeah, I would actually also recorded the anime every day at school. I have even still my tapes of, like, the first 104 episodes taped off of effing UPN or whatever.
Yeah, so I would come home, watch it, and then play Pokemon on my big, chunky, original fat Game Boy until the batteries ran out, basically. I'm just trying to think, like, when did I ever do homework? because then there was also Toonami to watch, like, around that 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock.
Well, era. Yeah, you needed to have your Dragon Ball Z, Sailor Moon, and Ronin Warriors.
See, I was kind of more into it in the, like, Tenchi Universe, Sailor Moon R, and...
I don't know what Sailor Moon R is.
It's the second season of Sailor Moon.
Oh, I just still call it Sailor Moon.
Anyway, so, yeah, I just remember, you know, laying on the couch. And I loved Yellow because you could get Bulbasaur, Squirtle, and Charmander from NPCs, which I always thought was really cool. You know, because, like, oh, you know, they're just basically given to you, kind of in the way that you get a first-gen starter from the sexy...
X and Y, right?
The sexy Professor Sycamore, yeah. Is the name Sycamore? Is that right?
It's Sycamore, yeah.
Yeah, I get them so mixed up because they're all based on trees. So I get them mixed up. They are oak, juniper.
Yeah, no, I birch. Know. I see what they did there.
Yeah. So I had Pikachu, Charizard, Blastoise, Venusaur. I had a like level 90 Pidgeot, and then Mewtwo. That was my team. Not really original, but I always thought it was kind of funny that that Pidgeot got a spot in my team like that.
Yeah, well, I think that's true for a lot of people, sort of that early on, because it was the first flying type you'd get.
Yeah, yeah.
They grew attached, and then it was like, oh, I kind of always want to have a Pidgeot.
And then, you know, sometimes I'd go through a couple runs of the Elite Four with my legendary bird trio and all that.
The only legendary bird I went for was Articuno.
You didn't even capture Zapdos or Moltres?
No, I effing captured them. I had to. I wanted to have 150 Pokemon.
It's just, the, like, as far as what you
But as far as using it, I used Articuno every damn
day. I used Zapdos a lot.
I'm kind of mad in X and Y, and I won't talk about X and Y too much, because I picked the wrong starter type to get Articuno in the game.
What?
I'm so mad. Like,
well, gotta get it.
I honestly am considering buying and playing through Y now just to get an Articuno.
I wouldn't blame you. And this here, folks, is what Pokemon does to you. You know, I don't want to talk too much about the anime and the movie throughout our discussion here, because we're going to talk about it kind of at the end as an overall look at the media franchise and the multimedia dealings that Pokemon has been involved in. But I remember when Pokemon the first movie came out, at that time I was into Yellow, I was into the cards, you know, I got my Ancient Mew card, and so I remember I didn't cut school for it. I know that you and Amanda cut school.
Yeah, we saw it a couple of times, and we cut school for it. So
we didn't cut school because my parents never would have allowed that, but we went on the...
Yeah, we didn't give a fuck.
We went, like, either after school Friday or on a weekend or something. I just remembered I was in ninth grade, and so we were in line, you know, because they had to have a special line for Pokemon, because it was, like, still opening weekend, I think. And so, you know, at that age, you know, my parents dropped me and my two friends off, and, you know, we were really excited. So, you know, we were, like, 14, 15. So we were able to be left alone at the theater, especially because it was a rated G movie. So, but we were in line with all of these, like, moms, and they're, like, 7, 8-year-old kids. And then I saw this girl who's kind of like this, like, jock girl who was, like, on, like, the track team. Like, you know, not like, the varsity track team or whatever, because she was a freshman, but... You know, so she was really, like, athletic and kind of popular, and she's like, oh, hey.
And did she sound like Robin Leach? Like, what was that?
I mean, but she wasn't, like, super friendly. I was like, oh, my God, this popular girl saw me in line at the Pokemon line at the theater. What is going to happen at school? And then I remember looking at the... newspaper ads, because, you know, this was 1999, and I was like, okay, well, what movie could I have pretended to have been in line for? And so I actually asked my mom the next day if we could go see Superstar, you know, which was based on the SNL sketch with Molly Shannon. So that if she...
Superstar!
If she had been like, were you in line for the Pokemon movie? I would have been like, no, I was in line to see Superstar! So that was kind of, like, my secret shame. You know, I mean, I guess, I don't know, like, it says more about me than the, you know, age group and that reaction to Pokemon, but that's my Pokemon the first movie story.
So you were in the closet as a Poke fan?
Well, yeah, and as a gay kid. I mean, so, you know, again, Game Boy Advance. We're going to have to explore some of these more personal issues with gaming. What you said that you imported Yellow, so you never bought a domestic copy of Yellow?
No, to this day, I have not played Yellow in English all the way through. I kind of would like to now, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fun. Did you ever have a Japanese surfing Pikachu? I think the only way to get the surfing Pikachu was through Stadium.
Yeah, I don't think I had one. I think you had to get it. I don't know off the top of my head if it was Stadium, so maybe, but There was some kind of there was some kind of distribution event. It wasn't just something you could get in the game. I only played it for maybe 3 or 4 hours, and then otherwise left it in its box just to look real pretty. I still have it. I mean, you know, of course I do. It's me, but
yeah.
But yeah, I didn't. I think about it now. I'd really like to play through that. I, you know, I don't normally hop on the bandwagon of Nintendo should release the Pokemon games on Virtual Console. But I'd play Yellow on Virtual Console if it was there, especially if they had a way to, like, upload from your save to Pokebank or whatever.
Yeah, that seems like a really, especially because we didn't see it with Fire Red Leaf Green, which we'll get to later. Now you might get a little thrown off if you're familiar with your English language release pattern, because the way that I'm going to be discussing these today and introducing these is by Japanese release. So this next game came out in Japan in December of 98, but we didn't get it until November of 2000. So it was not the first N64 game we got in the Pokemon franchise. This, of course, is Pikachu Genkei Deichu, known here as Hey You Pikachu.
I love Pikachu Genkei Deichu so much.
Did you have the Japanese version, Pikachu Genkei Deichu?
This I actually double-dipped on, and I actually got my mother to buy me Pikachu Genkei Deichu because I had sort of sold it to her as... And I guess the background information you need to know is that we had a great import gaming store here in the Bay Area, quite a few, in fact, in this vintage. And so I was literally like, this will help me practice with my Japanese language skills because... You know, you have to talk to Pikachu, and you have to pronounce words right and stuff. So that's it'd be a really...
That's crafty, because you had been in Japanese class.
Well, exactly school. So. So this must have been in 99, and I did not think this game was going to come to the U.S. Again, a lot of these weirder spinoffs I never dreamed we'd see come
here.
So I sold it real hard, like, you need to get this for me. It's going to be an educational tool, and it will make learning fun. And she totally went for it, and I got Pikachu Genkei Deichu, and I love that game. The way that the voice recognition worked at the time was incredible. Like, there was no other gaming experience like that.
Yeah, so this game is basically Seaman with Pikachu. It's a very rough way to compare it. It was developed by a company called Umbrella. Umbrella. And it was a voice recognition game. It was packaged in with a microphone. I feel like the marketing... Well, I mean, that's probably because of the marketing of Pokemon. Over here, it was really marketed as, like, a kind of a babyish game. Did you ever feel that way, too? Like, the way they kind of pushed it? Over here was kind of for, like, little kids?
In the U.S., I definitely felt that way.
And I think this was the game that came with that, like... Blue N64
The blue, yellow N64 that had, like, the light-up Pikachu cheeks when you turned it on.
Yeah. So I'm going to give some spoilers for Pikachu Genkei Deichu, Hey You Pikachu. So, in there, you know, time passes in-game. At the end of one in-game year, for the 365th day, Professor Oak tells you that you have to release your Pikachu into the wild. And so the way that you do this is by saying goodbye multiple times. I never played that much to know that, so I didn't find this out until later. I just kind of think, like, wouldn't that have scarred children emotionally? Like, they probably were fucking crying, like, super hard. Like, if this, you know, in here in the U.S. it was marketed to little kids, they have to say goodbye to Pikachu, and he, like, wouldn't leave. No, goodbye, Pikachu. Goodbye, Pikachu. But then the fucking worst part of it is that after the end credits, Pikachu comes back. So, like, emotionally scarred a generation of children, I'm sure. And then only to after the credits, he's like, Pika Pika!
Yeah, and it's really sweet because, you know, you have to make him go away because he doesn't want to go away. You're like, bye, 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 bye. Sayonara, sayonara, sayonara. And it's like, it's sad because, like, he doesn't want to go.
Did you have some feelings, even as a, you know, legally aged adult at that point?
No. I wasn't a legally aged adult, fool.
You were almost. You were, like, 17, right?
Yeah, I was 17.
You were basically an adult.
Basically. If we were in another country, I would have been a legal adult.
True. All right. So, anything else to say about Pikachu, Ginkidachu, P-A-U Pikachu?
Nope, just that I love it. I sort of told my personal anecdotes. I think it's a cool game. I would almost like to dig it up and play my copy again, but I'm worried that it won't have aged well.
Yeah.
In this age of Kinect and all that, and, you know, voice recognition that actually works, like, I kind of fear for Pikachu, Ginkidachu.
What would happen if you said, like, fuck dicks into it? Would it be like...
If you
would
cursed...
Professor Oast be like, no, that's not the way to talk to your Pikachu.
I seem to recall that if you cursed...
You didn't even compliment my pretty good Professor Oak voice.
It wasn't. I feel like if you cursed, Pikachu would make a little frowny face. Like, I remember it being not a good thing, but, you know.
Wow.
Also, if you mentioned, like, Sony or PlayStation, I seem to recall that Pikachu would get
okay,
mad.
Okay, that's hilarious. We'd be like, Pika Pika! All right. In December of 1998 in Japan, Pokemon Trading Card Game came out. And I'm not talking about the trading card game. I'm talking about a Game Boy Color game developed by Hudson Soft. It came out here in the North American regions in April of 2000. And later that year, December of 2000, in European regions. It was, of course, based on the trading card game. And you kind of travel around to, like, card clubs that are kind of similar to the gems from the mainline games. It was, you know, involved deck building based on the first three sets at the time of the TCG that were available. I really love this game. It, you know, it played like the card game, but digitally. And it was a lot of fun. It was a competent little mini RPG, so to speak.
And, you know, as someone who played the card game, this was a big deal for me. You know, I had decks and decks and decks and decks. And it was, for me at least, it was a big deal to have, you know, this whole game and the whole game rule set on a cartridge. And it really made everything a lot easier.
Yeah. Would you say that you had the biggest deck out of all the people you knew?
I'm not answering that. I feel like you had a salacious intonation, and I'm not feeding into that.
So, yeah, I really liked Pokemon TCG, or I believe in Japan it was called Pokemon Card GB, if I recall correctly. There was one sequel that we'll talk about very briefly in Generation 2, but I'm kind of sad that they never made more of these as the generations went on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I would love it if we could have a current-gen, like, 3DS trading card game that had all of the cards and card sets up to, you know, today. I recently started playing the Pokemon card game again, and I really like it a
lot. Yeah, me too, yeah.
And it just sucks that I have to have a whole card deck that I have to carry around with me if I want to play. I would be much happier if I could just buy even, like, an eShop download and then pay real money for packs of cards.
Right.
I wouldn't care.
I mean, and the thing is, with Magic the Gathering has had digital versions available for a couple years, yearly releases. Hearthstone from Blizzard is based on that whole premise. And so, you know, I really do feel like it's kind of an untapped... Well, and there is some sort of...
I was just going to say, in that context, there is an official sanctioned online PC game of the trading card game. That even does, like, booster packs. In fact, when you buy booster packs of the current sets, you
right.
get a download code for an in-game booster pack as well.
Yeah, I specifically would love to see this little mini RPG where you go around to the card clubs and build your deck. Like, I would pay real money for that. You know, I was especially surprised that with the e-reader for Game Boy Advance that they never introduced another
yeah.
game like that.
Yeah, me too. I thought for sure that when the e-reader came out, which I want to point out is different from a Scientology e-reader.
Oh, dear.
That's an e-meter, I guess.
Ah.
But I was really surprised that they never really tapped that market. You know, they did the virtual console cards, basically, and, like, the Mario 3 New World cards. But they didn't really do anything with Pokemon. It was really strange to me.
And, you know, with AR cards, even, you could think they're... There's got to be something that they could do. I guess maybe they're just not really interested in pursuing that. But anyway, Card GB, Pokemon trading card game for Game Boy Color. It was a Game Boy Color exclusive game. It wasn't one of the color carts that could work on a regular GB. So, in March of 1999 in Japan. Then in June of 1999 here in North America, September of 1999 in Europe, Pokemon Snap, developed by HAL Laboratory. Bitches love Pokemon Snap. We sure do. If you're maybe one of the two people out there, and I don't mean that in a patronizing way or a condescending way, if you're one of the few people who maybe aren't familiar with Pokemon Snap, you go around taking pictures of Pokemon on your N64. It's great. I've heard people describe it as like a rail shooter, but shooting with your camera instead.
That's not completely inaccurate.
The cool thing about this is that at the time, and this shows its age, you could go print your PokePix at a Blockbuster store. You'd bring in your
cartridge.
Your N64 cartridge.
Yeah.
I didn't mean bring in your N64. I was going to say your game card.
I thought you were saying you bring in your console. I'm like, no, it's just a cartridge.
No,
fool.
I printed out my Snap stickers.
Yeah, me too. I still have some. Like, I still have several complete sets of stickers.
Aw.
Of, like, my Mew shots and, like, my Pikachu standing on a surfboard shots. And
yeah, it was just great. And with the 3DS now and the Wii U, we all keep talking about why have they not made a sequel. Like, seriously, we want a sequel. Dream Radar, arguably, when we'll talk about Dream Radar when we get to the modern age, arguably is kind of a spiritual successor, but there has not been a Snap 2. And I'm sure that Nintendo knows if they put out a Snap 2, it would sell. There is demand for it in the Pokemunity. Any special anecdotes with, getting that perfect in-game shot?
I have a picture of Mew that is literally the highest score you could possibly get in-game for a picture. It is considered a perfect shot.
Excellent. Did you just feel, like, totally pumped after doing that?
Yeah, because I loved Pokemon Snap, and I loved Mew, and that game, man, I loved how, like, interactive it was, because, you know, you could take pictures, or you could throw, like, pest balls, or you could throw apples, and to make some things in the stages open up and to get certain pictures, you'd have to hit items in the level to interact with the environment and change the environment. So, like, you know, you'd have to, like, hit a Magikarp and make him angry enough to turn into Gyarados in order to get a Gyarados picture.
Oh, yeah.
Or you'd have to hit some Electavolts to get them to, like, shock a nearby generator.
Electabuzz.
Okay, Electabuzz, whatever. And I just loved all of that stuff. I loved all of the little cute touches they had in that game. I just thought it was something really special. To this day, there's been no other game that has really captured sort of the magic of Pokemon Snap. And I think there's a real hunger in the games community for another experience like this. I mean, I feel like I see it all the time being talked about. Like, oh, Pokemon Snap, Pokemon Snap.
Yeah, we want it.
Yes, we do want it.
So, yeah, there's no, like, so many of these, even Pikachu Genki-Dichu has had spiritual successors. And like we said, Dream Radar is really the only thing kind of similar. And, you know, we'll talk about that with Black and White 2, I think, specifically. In October of 1990, I'm sorry, not October. Just cut that out. In April of 1999 in Japan, June 99 here in the North American regions, and October of 2000 in European regions, came the Game Boy Color release Pokemon Pinball. It was developed by Jupiter, who you might be familiar with. Back in the day, doing Game Boy Camera, they also did some of the earlier Mario Picross games, and I still believe to you the Picross E?
Mm-hmm.
I know that you're familiar with. In the more modern age, you might be familiar with them from their work on Kingdom Hearts Chain of Memories and The World Ends With You. Pokemon Pinball was a Rumble Kart game, so it had like a little extra bumpy bit on the top, and you put a AA battery in there, and it simulated playing a pinball game.
Yeah.
You could capture and evolve Pokemon on the red table or the blue table. It was cute. A lot of pinball purists, you know, when I was kind of researching this, I was curious about, like, you know, what people thought about Pokemon Pinball as a pinball game. And, you know, pinball purists seem to be very picky about pinball simulation, as they
sure
should.
Are.
I'd be interested to hear Dark Sakura's thoughts on Pokemon pinball, because I know she's a big pinball wizard. But I remember having fun with. I remember having fun with it. I'm not a pinball purist. I'm not disrespecting those who, you know, are passionate about pinball in that way. But for me, it was fun. You know, it was right in the middle of Pokemania. And
bitch, you make it sound like Pokemania is dead.
No, well, I mean, Pokemania in the way of Beatlemania. And I mean, we'll talk about that with the cultural impact of Pokemon later on. Anything to say about Pokemon Pinball before we move on?
I really liked it, and I lost my copy of it in a divorce, so to speak, and it breaks my heart every day.
That's really sad. Pokemon Stadium! This game, known as Pocket Monster Stadium 2 in Japan, came out at the end of April 99 in Japan. We got it in February of 2000 here in North America, 2 months later in April of 2000 in Europe. This, like the previous Pocket Monster Stadium, was developed with help from HAL Laboratory. And of course, this one had all 151 Pokemon. It was actually originally intended to be a 64DD, 64 disc drive game. We should talk about the 64DD someday, just saying. One thing that a lot of people may not realize is that only the North American version had the transfer pack support. Like, I don't believe even the European one did, to my knowledge.
Now, on that count, I couldn't say for sure. I just know that it was not in the original Japanese release.
And, I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, to, you know, things like Pokemon Bank to this day kind of, I think, borrow from the idea of the transfer pack. And like I had mentioned earlier, there was, like, a surfing Pikachu that you could get for your yellow, and it was through, like, the battle tower or something like that. There was always different modes, you know. And the big appeal, of course, was a couple of friends, get your transfer packs, and have a Pokemon battle, as you would in the game, but up on the screen in full 3D. And, you know, I think that it was really, I just remember having a great time with it. It did not replace the core Pokemon experience for me, but, I mean, I remember it being kind of a big deal. My friends and I would be like, okay, I'm working on my team, and, you know, by this date, we're going to have a stadium tournament and see who wins. So, I mean, it's kind of like a big deal for me. And, you know, there was also, like, rentals that you could use. So, like, if I wanted to play against my sister, you know, you could just have a rental Pokemon. There were also, like, tournament rules. I feel like this is the first time that, like, Pokemon tournament rules really became a thing, which now if you do online, or, you know, not even online, you know, if I just pulled out my 3DS and played with you, there's different rule sets you can use. And, I mean, I don't think that was really incorporated into the handheld releases until a little bit later, probably with the Game Boy Advance ones, but, yeah, I really liked it. Pokemon Stadium, what was your experience with that?
Just, you know, it was cool. I was always really disappointed that there wasn't more to it. And, you know, that's sort of something that I think is a recurring unpleasantness in the way that Nintendo does approach their sort of experimental Pokemon console games. I think that a lot of people have bought these games expecting a full 3D Pokemon game, and when it's just almost more of like a battle arena, I think there's a little bit of a
negative reaction. The funny thing is that that's a very common complaint. I've never had a problem with that.
You're a Pokemaniac.
Yeah, I am. And your point being?
When I think about some adult friends whom I have, whoa, that makes it sound like I'm talking about fuck buddies. But no, I just mean friends who happen to be
adults.
This is
a Pokemon episode. We should have put a no cursing limitation.
Girl.
I guess this isn't Disney games.
Disney games! Stop! So, I think about adult friends I have whom have gotten into Pokemon with Black and White and now X and Y. And, you know, they look at, like, the Wii, was it Pokemon Coliseum?
Yeah.
Which is basically Pokemon Stadium, but for the more recent generations. And most of them who bought that game felt really ripped off that they had paid $50 for a battle arena on their TV, that they still had to use their 3DS or their DSs for. So, no, I don't...
I'm sorry, the Wii one was Battle Revolution.
Okay, well, Battle Revolution then, whatever. I think I saw a lot of negative backlash about that specific aspect. I think that that's a very common reaction among non-Pokemaniacs.
Right, right, which is totally valid. I think for me, the appeal always was training your team and then putting them on the big screen. So, yeah. In September of 2000 in North America and in March of 2001 in Europe, no Japanese release for this one was Pokemon Puzzle League for Nintendo 64. As you might have guessed, this was developed by Intelligent Systems. You probably know them because of Fire Emblem, but also because of Panel de Pon. Because this is Panel de Pon. Or I guess you could say Panel de Mon.
Well, you know, and again, a lot of Americans, a lot of our listeners might be more familiar with the Panel de Pon series as Tetris Attack.
Exactly. Or, you know, these days they call it Puzzle League, kind of in line with... I mean, I think this was the first time that Panel de Pon was called Puzzle League, actually.
I think you'd probably be correct there.
Although it might have come first with Dr. Mario Puzzle League. I can't tell you when that came out. We'll have to talk
about... Did that even come out in the U.S.?
I thought it did. We'll have to talk about that on our Puzzle Games episode.
We're never doing a Puzzle Games episode.
Well, we'll see about that. You said we were never going to do a Pokemon episode, and here we are. So,
I hate you.
One thing that I really liked about Pokemon Puzzle League, it was really based on the anime, but that's not what I liked about it. There was a really cool 3D mode that was kind of like a cylindrical mode where you rotated it around, and it was still, you know, Panel de Pon. But I thought that was a really clever kind of different play mode. There was also a 2D mode as well. And kind of notable for its time, there was full-screen VHS-quality FMV. I say it kind of like LOL, but I think there was only one other game at the time that had, like, you know, full-screen VHS-quality. You know, this was pre-DVD, so, I mean, that was a pretty big deal. And it was, of course, it was a little bit creepy because it was, like, Ash was at the, Poke Resort. And he was, like, in his swimsuit, and I'm like, yeah, I don't want to see that. I kind of have attitude with Ash, but, you know, so, I mean, that was kind of a big deal, especially when FMVs were, like, a big deal back in that kind of late 90s era. so...
Yeah, well, you know, and again, it's really interesting because a lot of people really felt strongly that the Nintendo 64 couldn't handle FMV sequences.
Well, you know, Resident Evil 2, Wheel of Fortune.
You're cheating and looking at a list on Wikipedia, I bet. But yeah, Resident Evil 2, a N64 copy of which I recently acquired, in fact, which is awesome. Recently acquired. Also, like some of the anime games that Namco Bandai, well, just Bandai at the time, had been involved with Banpresto. The Neon Genesis Evangelion Nintendo 64 game comes to mind. It had some great FMV sequences. And that was actually, like, the best Neon Genesis Evangelion game that was made. So, certainly I think the most notable would probably be Pokemon Puzzle League, certainly. But, again, it's easy to look at it as like, oh, this is something that nobody thought was possible, but a lot of games actually did this.
Yeah. You played Pokemon Puzzle League contemporaneous with its release, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I loved Tetris Attack, and so I've actually done my best over the years to get all of those games.
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of like, you know, You had a team of three Pokemon, and then, like, those were your three rounds, and then after your Pokemon were all KO'd, you lost.
You know, something I want to say about Pokemon Stadium that I hadn't known previously when it was contemporaneous, apparently you could snap photos of your Pokemon in the gallery and have them printed at Pokemon Snap Stations at Blockbuster.
I kind of, now that you say that, I remember that, but I forgot about that, so I'm glad that you research that. So, with Pokemon Puzzle League Stadium 2 officially in Japan, but here in the English-speaking part of the world, Pokemon Puzzle League was the end of the first generation. And, you know, that's kind of notable because even with all the Pokemania, a lot of people thought it was just going to be this fad. If you look at a lot of the mainstream media at the time, and also if you kind of go back and look at some more academic work done, like, you know, some books, research papers that were published on this Pokemania trend, which are actually out there, you know, if you're curious about that, hit me up on Twitter or whatever, mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org. Because there's actually was at the time, you know, this kind of attitude that that was the height of Pokemania and it was a dying trend. So the fact that there was Generation 2 on its way was kind of a big deal. And, you know, the hype leading up to Generation 2, you had mentioned it with Pikachu Summer Vacation. There was the first appearance of Meryl and Snubbull. And once we talk about Gold and Silver proper in just a moment, I want to talk about Meryl because there's, of course, well, I mean, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about with Meryl, but Pokemon Gold and Silver.
I think you mean Pika Blue.
Oh, don't even go there, but yes. Pokemon Gold and Silver came out in 1999, November of 99 in Japan, and then we got it a year later, October of 2000. And then Europe got it in April of 2001. I want to point out that kind of traditionally it's become a pattern that these games typically hit in the October-November range, these mainline Pokemon games. So the thing about Pokemon Gold and Silver that I want to talk about before we get into the nitty-gritty of it is that even though we typically associate it with the Game Boy Color, it was actually a Game Boy game that supported full color. So, you know, I didn't realize that at the time. I think I went out and got a Game Boy Color so I could play Gold and Silver. So, you know, but I think that really enriches the experience. It was beautiful.
Yeah, Gold and Silver was a beautiful, beautiful game. I mean, I guess set of games, but, you know, game.
Right, right.
And that's something that I really, to me, was sort of the biggest jump. I didn't get into Gold and Silver as much as I got into Red and Blue. I thought that some of the quote-unquote changes they made for me were extremely detrimental to playing the game.
Hmm.
So I just, it was not a really a good fit for me as a gamer.
Right. I'll be curious to hear about your what you didn't like when we talk about some of those changes in a moment.
But graphically, as you said, yeah, it was a huge step up. I thought that the designs were a lot more complex. That certainly the use of color made things way more interesting compared to the little color that we saw in Red and Blue when playing on a Super Game Boy.
Exactly.
I had a Super Game Boy. I still have one, of course. And I played Pokemon Red nearly entirely on my TV when I was at home. Playing on my Game Boy only when I was going to school to play.
That makes sense, yeah. The Super Game Boy, man, that was really just, man, Nintendo. But anyway, of course, the most obvious addition to the game was that there were 100 new Pokemon. You could explore the new Johto region. This was also the game that introduced the Dark and Steel types, which until Fairy type came out were the only new types to have been introduced. It also introduced the held items, including your berries. It was backwards compatible with Red, Blue, and Yellow to a certain degree. You know, obviously more compatible on the Gold Silver side of it. Also notable was the internal clock. You know, that there were different times of the day, mostly day and night, but I think it was also like day, afternoon, night. I think it was what
and,
it was.
And I want to say, you know, that's, for me, that was a major disincentive to playing this game. So major, in fact, that to this day I've never actually played it all the way through, because I'm very much, when I play Pokemon games, collecting is a big part of the game for me. And I had just started my first real serious adult job when this game came out. I could not play in the day. Like, I'm
yeah,
sorry,
you were
no.
working nights.
I... Well, no, in this first, the first year or two, I was working in the day.
Oh.
And okay. I would go into work at 6, and I would typically not be home, because, you know, I'd have to walk something like 7 or 8 miles home after work. I would not be home until, you know, 4 or 5 in the evening. By the time I could play, there was no time to catch the daytime Pokemon.
Mm.
And this, for me, ended up really, making the game, something I didn't want to play, because I got very frustrated that I could not catch all the Pokemon I wanted.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting perspective that I didn't have at the time. I'd play, you know, for me, I think the early morning ones were, like, most difficult, because I'd be in school or getting ready for school. But, you know, there'd be times that I'd wake up and, you know, gotta catch... I can't tell you off the top of my head what the day and night Pokemon were. I mean, I think a Noctowl or Hoot-Hoot was... Hoot-Hoot was a little Noctowl, right? Basically just a circle-shaped owl. And that's another thing. Some of these Pokemon designs through the years kind of like, what? But Hoot-Hoot was cute. But, you know, like, that was a nighttime Pokemon, a nocturnal Pokemon. So that's interesting that, you know, a lot of people considered it a big deal, a big design step forward, but for you, it just made it inconvenient.
Well, and, you know, I still see people talk about how they wish there was still, like, a clearly delineated night and dark
cycle
in these games. And, you know, the games do, even the ones that don't have night and day systems... still do utilize the clock for certain events happening only at certain times of the day. But I, you know, I look at it like, dude, I'm a busy man. I have a real life work schedule. Mm-hmm. I cannot work around for a game. So for me, it's very important that a system like that, like, I really think that that is a bad thing for gamers. I think that locking down the time you have to play to achieve something, I really think, is it disincentivizes playing for some of the people who would probably be most devoted to buying your games mm-hmm. and playing them and supporting them.
Interesting. And then, you know, the same thing with some of the things like the bug catching contest is what I remember the most being happening on various days. But what if you couldn't play on a Thursday? I don't know if it was actually Thursday. So, I mean, I think my perspective of it is that, you know, I think mostly as a design choice, it was great, but I do recognize that for a lot of people, it might have been detrimental. One thing I do know is that my carts of gold and silver are dead. My yellow cart still works. My gold and silver cart, because of that internal clock battery or whatever, just, you know, wiped itself. So that's sad.
That sucks, yeah.
Especially because I love these games. I have a little anecdote I'll share in a few minutes, but another thing that was a change was that the special stat was split into special attack and special defense, which kind of required a little more strategy.
But it was a good change.
It was a good change. The legendary beasts, you know, a lot of people call them dogs, but there's arguments over that. So the legendary beasts, Raikou, Entei, and Suicune, were wandering around after you went to, like, the Burnt Tower, I think it was, which was where Ho-Oh was. I know way too much about these games. But they wandered around the world, and I think they even wandered around, spoiler alert, Kanto, which is better known as the world of the original Red, Blue, Yellow. It's also a region in Japan. These games are, for those who might not know, based on regions in Japan up until... I mean, definitely X and Y was not based on a region of Japan, but people have actually looked and been like, oh, yeah, the Kanto region of Japan actually kind of matches up roughly with the overworld map of Red and Blue.
Yeah, and, like, for example, Sinnoh was clearly based on Hokkaido.
Yes.
So I was very excited that X and Y broke from that and was clearly based in Paris.
Although I don't think the geography was supposed to specifically be...
I don't know about that, but I mean, you look at the game. And it's...
No, but I'm saying that, like, I think that's healthy that they broke away from that. But it was kind of neat at the time, being like, ooh, what region of Japan are they going to do next?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I can't wait to see the American Pokemon game. We're going to have some Pokemon that look like syringes that have been discarded. Some cigarette butts.
Oh, well, maybe there's already, like, a trash Pokemon.
Some tomahawks being held by frowning Indians or something.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Oh, no! So yeah, one thing that made this game feel huge is that after you beat the Elite Four, and I guess we should say the Elite Four, we didn't really even talk about the basic premise of a Pokemon game, but I don't think we need to.
Well, why don't you do that right now?
The basic premise of a Pokemon game is that you are a Pokemon trainer whose goal is to collect Pokemon out in the Pokemon world. Pokemon are helpful creatures.
We're only an hour plus into this episode.
Pokemon are creatures with magical abilities.
Magical?
There's actually, I think, some in canonical explanations that they were considered magical creatures before they got the name Pokemon. Ash actually traveled back in time and coined the term Pokemon, creating a time paradox or something. It was in one of the movies.
Are you fucking kidding me right
now? No, like, I didn't watch that movie, but that apparently was the plot of one of the movies that Ash invented the term Pokemon. Ash also met the young Professor Oak.
We should go to the video store and buy all the Pokemon movies.
Let's not. Let's not do that.
I'm gonna.
So anyways, you are traveling around with these elemental creatures. Pokemon is a role-playing game involving, you know, stats and...
Oh my gosh, is it like Skyrim?
A little different. And so basically, you know, you're going around building a team, an RPG team, but you are collecting these pocket monsters, fighting at different elemental-themed gyms, and then you, after you beat the 8 gyms, you fight the Elite Four as part of the Pokemon League in order to become the Pokemon Master. So, what was significant about Gold and Silver is that after you beat the Elite Four, who are like kind of like the most powerful trainers, you got to go on, and you went through a cave, and you found the old land of Kanto. And you got to play through all the red, blue, yellow gyms that it was like 5 years later or something. So Misty and Brock were like adults now, and I think Koga was replaced by his daughter. I don't know if he died or something. I think he just retired.
No, he died.
Oh, you know what happened? He actually, I think, spoiler alert, was part of the Elite Four.
Oh.
Because I think something Lance, I don't know. But, you know, so that was, it really felt like a huge game. There were 16 badges. To this day, it is the biggest game, I think, in the series. And another thing that was really, you know, a lot of these things to this day, like, you know, the held items and such were, we still see to this day, and we kind of just take for granted. But breeding and eggs started in Pokemon Gold and Silver at the daycare center. So, of course, the notable one is that the daycare center would give you an egg that hatched into a Togepi, which, of course, kind of, you know, tied into the anime, Togepi being another one that made an early appearance before it was ever appeared in-game. So, I want to talk about, before I talk about my experiences with Gold and Silver, you kind of talked about yours, that they weren't super in-depth, but I want to talk about the lead-up to Gold and Silver, because we were talking, you had told me, and I didn't realize this for a long time, that these were originally intended to be kind of the swan song, that they never intended to make it more than...
Well, yeah, that is... that's why they included, you know, the both regions, both the original region and the new region, as that this was supposed to be, like, the ultimate Pokemon experience.
Yeah, and, you know, there was a lot of hype back in the time in between the two generations about, oh, you know, there's these secret Pokemon, and people would make, like, these fake gifts, of Pokédex entries, and one of them was Pikablu. So there was this whole rumor about Pikablu, and it was a blue Pikachu, which is ironic that in that detective game that's coming out that there is a blue Pikachu, apparently. But a lot of people, when they saw Meryl in the Pikachu Summer Vacation, thought that Meryl was Pikablu. And so I didn't you actually name your Azurill, you know, evolves into Meryl and Azurill. Azumarill, I'm sorry.
Yes, I named it Pikablu.
That's what I thought. So, I'm sure other people our age probably remember the Pikablu story.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know...
And I couldn't with it. I'm like, that's obviously fake.
Something that's funny, you know, about the entire idea of Pokemon ending with Gold and Silver is that, you know, Nintendo and, you know, all of the Pokemon, various Pokemon entities, they all sort of collaborated and focused all of their energies on Pokemon for a minute there in the hopes of making Pokemon Gold and Silver sort of like their new, like the new biggest game of all time. And it was, again, supposed to be the end of the series, and the idea was with, you know, the trading card game really building up and the anime building up and leading toward the end of its first, you know, production season. Everything was supposed to feed into the sales of this game. And it sort of had the unintended at the time side effect of basically creating demand for this to be like the new mega franchise of Nintendo.
Yeah.
Because they created this real hunger that they had intended to only be for, you know, this one game. But again, people at this point had been sort of trained to, you know, if there's all of these different arms of this franchise and it's this big, like, there was a real hunger for more. I know, for example, that Shigeki Morimoto-san from Game Freak has said in interviews, you know, that they all thought that come, you know, the anticipated release in 1999, that by, you know, the year 2000 and starting the new century, that they were all going to be working on new, completely unrelated projects.
Yeah, and here we are today. I remember getting because we didn't even know for sure that this was going to be released outside of Japan. So I just remember being really passionate about any news that I could find about Gold and Silver. I remember when EGM officially, they were like the exclusive Western publisher to release the full Pokédex. So I remember getting that issue. Do you remember that Gold Silver issue of EGM? It showed the official art for all the Pokémon?
Yes.
And I mean, because the internet was still kind of, you know, growing at that stage, you know, what you couldn't find on the internet, you know, that was like the first, oh, yep, here's the official listing of all 100 new Pokemon.
Yep, absolutely.
And so I remember that being a big deal in the lead-up for me. Who was your, I know you said you didn't spend a lot of time, but who was your starter?
I don't even remember what starters were in that game.
There was Cyndaquil, the kind of cute little, like, spiny anteater with the fire.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
His back. There was Totodile, the water crocodile, and Chikorita.
I went Totodile, because, again, I had good luck with my Squirtle, Squirty, mm-hmm. So I went with a Totodile named Squirty Jr.
Aww. See, I went with Chikorita. I thought she was really cute, and for some reason I decided, oh, because that's the other thing that I almost forgot to mention. This game introduced gender.
And yeah, that's a big deal. You did mention breeding, but you did not mention gender.
Yeah, and, you know, that's kind of what made Pokemon breeding possible was, you know, the addition of gender, and the thing that kind of was the unintended side effect was, oh, Mr. Mime could be male or female, and, you know, Mr. Mime was, you know, of course, only the Western name for it.
So I guess you're implying that they wrote themselves into a wall.
Yeah. And you,
or into a corner.
We've had conversations about this, and you're like, I don't even see what the big deal is. But it just bothers me that, you know...
Then give it the nickname Miss Mime. Jeez, it's not that hard.
No, but it's your female Mr. Mime, Miss Mime. Like, they should have just made it a separate species at that point.
Like Nidoran male and Nidoran female?
Exactly. Which is interesting, because that was the only time there was two genders of the same-ish Pokemon. So Nidoran was kind of interesting. And then, you know, Nidorina, Nidorino, Nidoqueen, Nidoking. Anyway, yeah, so I just kind of remember that being a big deal, the whole gender thing, and then me being like, oh, but why is Mr. Mime a female? Because it wasn't called Mr. Mime, so I thought that was a stupid localization choice. But, you know, there was no way of knowing at that time, I guess. So, I have a really fond memory, you know, not specific memory. Actually, no, I do have a specific memory. I was You know, probably at that point, yeah, I just turned 16. And I remember going through the Bellsprout Tower, and it was just, like, raining out, and, you know, I was just kind of, you know, just laying in bed, playing my copy of Silver, with going through the Bellsprout Tower, listening to The Strokes' Is This It on repeat. So, like, anytime I think of that album or this game, I associate them with each other in that time. So that's just kind of my... my special thing. I have some more music-related memories with games, but that sounds like a Game Buoy Advance episode, doesn't it?
Man, you're really trying to get these Game Buoy Advance things to happen.
I am. So, yeah, I really liked Gold and Silver. I recognize that you weren't as big of a fan for the reasons you delineated, but, you know, like we said, it was kind of intended to be the swan song, and it just caused Pokemania to explode even more. Any final thoughts on Gold Silver?
Not really. You know, again, for me, this was sort of the lost generation of Pokemon, almost.
Yeah. After Gold and Silver, in September of 2000 in Japan, December of 2000 here in North America, and June of 2001 in Europe, was Pokemon Puzzle Challenge. As you might have guessed, this was a panel-to-pawn game developed by Intelligent Systems. There was no 3D mode. It was just classic panel de pawn.
Well, it was a Game Boy Color game, so yeah, it would have been tough.
With it's, Gold Silver Pokemon.
Yeah, it's basically just Pokemon Puzzle League, but for Game Boy Color, and with the limitations that that would imply.
Yeah. I had it. It was good. It was
panel de pawn. Yeah, I still have a copy.
I like panel de pawn a lot. It's one of my favorite puzzle games.
Yeah, me too.
And you said you have nothing to say about puzzle.
No, I have tons to say about puzzle games. I just don't think we need to do a puzzle game buoy.
Puzzle game buoy, buoy, game buoy. Pokemon Stadium 2 in Japan was known as Pocket Monsters Stadium King, Gold and Silver. It was released in December of 2000 in Japan, March 2001 in North America, October 2001 in Europe. Developed by HAL Laboratory once again. I don't really have much to say. It was more of the same. And, you know, I can think of maybe a lot of people, like you said, were disappointed that Stadium 2 didn't offer more.
Yeah. You know, and it's really, it's almost the exact same game. I mean, again, this is really, to me, sort of the lowest in terms of creativity that the Pokemon series has seen, because it's basically the exact same game experience. It's basically the exact same game experience, just, you know, with more Pokemon.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not even, I wouldn't even really say that, like, the character models were better for the original 150. It's just, like, basically the same shit, but with a little more added.
It was a cash-in, and I bought into it, not gonna lie. What was more notable for me, and this was actually...
Mini-game park.
Oh, the stadium games did have some kind of silly mini-games that were kind of cute, like...
Yeah.
There was one with, I remember there was one with Jigglypuffs and Clefairies or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah. There were some silly ones. There was like a Psyduck one, I think.
Gutsy, Golbat, Topsy Turvy, Clear Cut Challenge, Furret's Frolic, Barrier Ball, Pichu's Power Plant, Rampage Rollout,
oh!
Screaming Stampede, Tumbling Togepi, Delibird's Delivery, Egg Emergency, and Eager Eevee.
Wow. I'm glad you mentioned Pichu, because one of the big deals in Gold and Silver were pre-evolutions. That, you know, because they came before, they were called baby Pokemon, I guess, to some people. There was Igglybuff, which was a baby Jigglypuff. There was Cleffa, who was a baby Clefairy. Togepi was meant as a baby, but, you know, because it hatched from an egg. You know, so it was kind of this whole thing with the breeding in the eggs. Also, it was like, ooh, what could you discover? There was Elekid, which was a baby Electabuzz. Magby, a baby Magmar, sorry. I'm wanting to say that's it. Pichu was a baby Pikachu. So, you know, and as we've seen, every game has a little electric-type rodent. Pichu was the one in Gold and Silver. So, release day and date with Stadium 2 in Japan was Pokemon Crystal for Game Boy Color. It came out in July of 2001 here in North America, November of 2001 in Europe. I thought that Crystal was never going to come to the U.S. because of the mobile adapter GP, which was a Japan-only device that hooked up to your, you know, Nokia phone, you know, those old ones with, like, the rubbery buttons and stuff that you played Snake on, and allowed you, it was a very primitive.
I love that you look at old phone devices as, oh, this is my Snake device. Like, no, that was from a day when phones were mainly just used for phones and games were, like, a slight little aside. It wasn't, like, a real focus.
No, no, I remember in high school people were like, I'm playing Snake on my Nokia.
Yeah, I was really just really pointing out sort of the generational difference in terms of thought in race, cell phones and stuff.
Well, I mean, my parents had a car phone that was, like, massive, a Verizon cell phone. But this isn't cell phone buoy.
Ooh, you fancy bitch.
This wasn't cell phone buoy, even though we talked about those Docomo phones.
To the Docomo.
Anyway, so I didn't think, for whatever reason, that Crystal was going to make it over because of this GB mobile adapter. This was the only way to officially get Celebi at the time. The GB mobile adapter, actually, mobile adapter GB was a proper name, sorry, allowed you to communicate wirelessly. So kind of a innovative sort of thing, but we never saw it. You know, it kind of just never really panned out. This was a Game Boy Color-only game, so unlike Gold and Silver, you could not play it on the old-school Game Boy. Another notable addition was that you could play as a girl now if you wanted. So I did. I played as Crystal in English. But the thing that is kind of notable, you know, I talked about having two copies each of Red and Blue, having Yellow. I had Gold and Silver. I imported Crystal because I thought it wasn't going to come over here.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I had played Gold and Silver, like, you know, I understood what was going on. You know, I might have to look up what movesets maybe had changed level-wise, but otherwise, you know, I got through it fine. But then, in addition to the import Crystal, I got two domestic copies of Crystal. So I had three copies of Crystal, which was kind of overkill.
Oh, wow.
Which was kind of overkill, but I really liked it. It had a few new subplots kind of in the vein. This was like the Yellow of Generation 2. And so, you know, can change a few plots. I don't know if it tied in with the anime at all. I wasn't following the anime as much at that point. But it involved the Unknown and Suicune, who was my favorite legendary beast from that era. Something that was cool was animated sprites. Like, the little flames on Cyndaquil's black would flicker. That's one I specifically remember. And then the Battle Tower was a new way to test your Pokemon abilities. And there's been some variation of Battle Tower ever since. Generation 2, when you consider that, you know, even Generation 1 had a lot of games, Generation 2 was kind of like the tiniest generation so far. So, Crystal was the end of Generation 2. Did you have any experience with Crystal?
No, I skipped Crystal because, again, you know, I had attitude about that entire run of Pokemon.
Yeah, I wonder if Game Buoy superfan Crystal D has experience with Pokemon Crystal.
I doubt it.
She should, though. It's Pokemon
You're
her.
You're being namist.
It's Pokemon her.
You're being namist. Stop.
So, with the release of the GBA came Generation 3 of Pokemon. Like we said, kind of a little bit of a surprise to some. But, I mean, not for me. I mean, I never really knew at the time that there was this attitude that Pokemon was dying. You know, it was kind of a... I think it's kind of a way to compare it in a modern way is that how Born This Way, Lady Gaga's album, sold 1 million copies, but Art Pop has not sold as much, so, oh, Lady Gaga's career is dying. It's like, no. But anyway...
This isn't Gaga, Buoy.
Yes, Gaga. In November of 2002 in Japan, March 2003 here in North America, and July 2003 in Europe, came Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire. A lot of people feel like they took a lot away from the games, and I feel that the games get a bad rap for this. There were no sprite animations. There was no day or night.
Bullshit.
It was not compatible with the previous generations. So a lot of people feel like it was kind of, you know, like, a lot of features were taken out and that made the game worse. I don't think so, and I feel like you probably would have liked. Did you get back into this franchise?
You know, I did, To a degree, again, this is another one of those games where you may remember just a few years ago I was out on a wild hunt for a copy of Ruby. Because
Ruby.
I had a copy of Ruby and I loved it. I was totally here for it. Yes, Gaga and all of that. But again, I lost my copy of it in a divorce, so to speak.
Oh, that's right.
And this would have been with the unpleasant one that didn't like that we were friends, but I won't go into any further more than that.
Right, right.
Because it would be inappropriate to defame someone online. But I liked the game a lot. I thought that it was a huge step in the right direction. I loved all of the art. I noticed that a lot of people got really upset about, like, the lack of, like, sprite animations and things.
But, you know, the sprites looked really great.
But I thought the sprites were superb, yeah. I thought that Hoenn was a great region to explore.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the introduction of double battles. I loved, you know, natures.
Natures and abilities. I mean, a lot of people focus on what Ruby Sapphire took out from Gold Silver. That, I mean, the abilities and the natures really, you know, are something, again, we take for granted. That was introduced in Ruby and Sapphire.
I just think it follows, you have to consider that they put all of this effort into Gold and Silver, and they put every feature that they ever had on the drawing board in, because they thought it was their last shot, and they were a small studio then. They had like 10 people working on Gold and Silver.
Right.
And, you know, in order to turn around and do a bigger game like Ruby Sapphire, and by which I mean bigger in that they had to completely redo all of the art assets from scratch. This is a new platform with, you know, new capabilities, completely different methods of, like, color and what have you. So they had to redo everything from the ground up. I think that they already had a monumental task at hand to do the, at this point, like, 400 Pokemon they had.
Yeah, one thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that they broke from the, well, I mean, I guess I had just assumed that they would keep adding 100 in each, so it would make it, like, 151, 251, 351, but they added 135 new Pokemon.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, they added these new features like double battles and abilities and natures. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, they already made monumental changes to what they had going on.
Right.
Something like the day-night cycle, which I already saw as rubbish, and the sprite animations, to me it was just like, well, that's what you gotta do to get a game this size put together.
Right.
As far as not being compatible with previous generations, I really thought that that was simply sort of, you know, a symptom of the fact that they moved from one platform to a new platform.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the starters here, some people may think, like, oh, that the starters weren't as cool as the originals, but there was Treecko, Torchic, who I love Torchic, and then, hey, so I heard you like Mudkips. Mudkip of internet meme fame came from Ruby Sapphire. Also, Pokemon Kid, who's like, you know, the long-haired kid with all the Pokemon. Remember really that video that you probably saw back in the day on E-Bomb's World? was in the advanced generation, so to speak. I think that was one of the anime season titles. So, who did you pick for Ruby?
Mudkip.
I did, too, because Swampert was a water and ground type, and, I mean, that's great because it's, you know, immune to electric, which is a big deal for a water type.
Yeah, I don't really look at, like, types that way. I still don't.
I know that about you. So, yeah, I heard you like Mudkips. And now, as you talked about, we kind of saw in the console space the experimental modes, so to speak. For the GameCube in 2003, November 2003 in Japan, February 2004 North America, March 2004 Europe, Genius Sonority, a company, developed this game, Pokemon Coliseum. It was a spiritual successor to the stadium games. It had a stadium sort of mode, but I think it's most known for its story mode, which is an RPG set in the Land of Ore, where you have to snag shadow Pokemon who had been corrupted. And then you can purify them, but then you can trade them to your GBA game. So I thought that was pretty cool. I liked this a lot. You know, a lot of people complained at the time, I feel, that it wasn't a full Pokemon experience. But I really liked the story mode in Coliseum.
Yeah, me too.
And it, of course, led into XD, which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
I liked XD a lot.
Oh, you like S? I thought you were going to say something else. I'm not going to say, but you know what I'm going to say.
You're bad at it.
So this next game was really, I think, the turning point in the franchise. and really just so innovative, and you could tell there was a lot of passion put into it. I'm, of course, talking about Pokemon Box Ruby and Sapphire, which was a GameCube game released for released in May of 2003 in Japan, July of 2004 in North America, and at some unspecified point in 2004 in Europe as Pokemon Memory Magic. In North America, it was only available at the Pokemon Center in NYC, which is now the Nintendo World. In Europe, you were only able to get it either through a Coliseum GameCube bundle or through the Stars catalog, which is kind of like their version of Club Nintendo. I don't know if now they've just solidified that into Club Nintendo Europe, whatever. It came with a cable to connect your GameCube, Game Boy Advance, and a memory card 59. So it's basically Bill's PC from the first game. Bill's PC is, of course, the storage system that the character Bill designed. And it's on your GameCube memory card. You can take screenshots and play with your Pokemon, but really aside from that, you could also play the GBA games on your TV without having a Game Boy Advance player. So, I mean, that was kind of cool, but, you know, because it was so limited, I never had Pokemon Box. And I remember a lot of reviewers, like IGN at the time, would be like, this is worthless, it's pointless, why is this game not a game? But, you know, for all the hate that it gets, it kind of set the precedent for Pokemon Bank that we see coming soon. Did you ever have Pokemon Box somehow? Did you eBay it?
I do not. I have, you know, just like one of the bonus discs that came around this time that had Jiraichi on it. But
yeah,
I don't have
the
actual Pokemon Box disc, no.
Well, maybe you had Pokemon Channel. Actually, that was just Europe and Australia that unlocked a Jiraichi. But Pokemon Channel was the next game to come out for GameCube that was available in Japan in July 2003, December 2003 here in North America, April 2004 in Europe. It was developed by Umbrella, who made Hey You Pikachu. It's kind of the Hey You Pikachu, Pikachu Genki Dachu spiritual sequel. The plot involved a Pokemon channel, hence the title, that you were beta testing. And Pikachu moves in with you and kind of watches a Pokemon channel.
I never actually played that. It looked kind of derpy.
It kind of looked derpy, I was just about to say.
But in retrospect, I wish I had played it so that I could talk about it right now.
Yeah. And only Europe and Australia had got the unlockable Jirachi, so there must have been some other bonus disc. And I remember that, actually, at the time. After that, for Game Boy Advance, in August 2003 in Japan, August 2003, also in North America, so not a long, kind of contemporaneous release, and November 2003 in Europe, was Pokemon Pinball Ruby and Sapphire. It was another Jupiter game. It was a sequel to Pokemon Pinball. I didn't own it, so I can't really say much about it, but Pokemon Pinball. Did you have Pinball Ruby and Sapphire?
I did, and I lost it in that same divorce, because
he was a Pokemaniac?
I got him into Pokemon, yeah. And he loved the Pokemon pinball games, too. In fact, the only one of this generation of games that he didn't take, and we'll get to it in a moment, was my copy of Fire Red.
Yeah.
So I do still have my copy of Fire Red, delightfully.
I'm sorry for your Poke loss.
Thank you. I lament it.
So, in January 2004 in Japan, September 2004 in North America, and October 2004 in Europe, was Pokemon Fire Red and Leaf Green. They were remakes of Red and Green, or, you know, Red and Blue, if you think of it this way, kind of officially, you know, recognizing that, yes, it was green in Japan. This was a big deal because it let you trade the original 151 to the other GBA games. I can't remember at the time, you know, nowadays there's like a mixture of Pokemon available in the newer games from older generations, but I'm wanting to say at the time that there were no Pokemon from the original generation in Ruby Sapphire. I could be wrong, but so I mean that was a big deal, and it, you know, was remade with the Ruby Sapphire engine, and, you know, just great, because it was Pokemon Red and Green, Red and Blue. There was, like, a tutorial feature that was added. There's a little thing that, you know, is common in certain JRPGs that shows you, like, what you did before you saved the game.
Yeah, it was like a little diary that, like, the last four major events that had happened in the game, it would replay them for you so that you knew where you were when you were last playing.
Yeah, so not anything too innovative. I know that was done in other games. I can't think off the top of my head what the first game to do that was, but, you know, still a cute little quality of life change. And then in September 2004 in Japan, April 2005 in North America, October 2005 in Europe, came Pokemon Emerald, which is, of course, is the crystal or yellow equivalent for this generation. And up until previous generation, this was kind of expected, that there was going to be a supplemental game, a third game in the generation. This one had a modified plot involving Rayquaza, who was a legendary dragon-y dude. Instead of the Battle Tower from Crystal, there was the Battle Frontier, which also coincided with an anime season that I, at this point, was just like, meh. It brought back animated sprites, yay. The one thing that I remember that was hilarious, and I don't even know, we might have LOL'd about this at the time because we knew each other at this point. This is when we really, you know, started exploring our love of games together and such in a big way.
You make us sound like lesbians.
I wasn't friendly to you, Holland. sorry, that
we're
was...
We're bad. Oh,
I'm
gosh.
Offensive. Do you remember in the Nintendo Power, they said, oh, the sales of Emerald, if there was a real Emerald, the value would be more...
The size of the ruby that would be of equivalent value to the sales this game would rack up would be the size of the moon or
no,
something.
No, it was if the amount, the total amount that Emerald sold, if it was a real Emerald, that Emerald would be the size of Neptune. That's how much money it made. But then
that's even bigger than the moon.
Yeah, and then people who like work with emeralds and stuff were like, no, that's not accurate, actually. And the reason that I was having trouble even, like, putting this into words was because it was hilarious.
It is worth mentioning that as of 2011, this game was still selling well in Japan. It reported nearly 10,000 units in sales that year.
Wow!
Which, while not a huge number taken on its own, you know, you keep in mind how many generations old it is at that point, and it's still moving units.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe not the size of Neptune, but, you know.
Uranus.
Don't you know my ass is famous? Pokemon XD, Gale of Darkness, known in Japan as Pokemon XD Yami no Kaze Dark Lugia, which I guess would be, like, Dark Lugia's Wind of Darkness. Do you have a better translation for that? Because, you know, I know what Yami and Kaze mean, but Yami no Kaze Dark Lugia.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's like Dark Wind.
Dark Wind of the Dark Lugia.
Basically, not even of the, I mean.
Dark Wind, Dark Lugia.
Say it again.
Pokemon XD, Yami no Kaze, Dark Lugia.
Yami no Kaze, so that's like the Winds of Darkness, Dark Lugia.
Darkness, Dark Lugia. I keep getting stuck on that, dark.
It's like the darkness owns the wind, Dark Lugia. Like, that's not that cute, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. This came out for the GameCube in Japan in August 2005. A month later, in September 2005 in North America, and in Europe in November 2005. So, you know, starting to see a little bit closer release dates for particularly these console releases. It was a sequel to Colosseum, developed once again by Genius Sonority. It had a plot involving a Shadow Lugia. A difference from the Colosseum story mode was that there were Poké spots where some wild Pokémon could appear. Because, you know, the whole idea with these console RPGs was that it wasn't wild Pokémon. You had the Poké Snatcher. Not to be confused with the Game Snatcher. You know, so a lot of people, I think, felt like, oh, I like wild Pokemon, so they added some wild Poke spots where you put out Poke food. Kind of similar to the way that we saw Snubble and Meryl in the movies before they were in the game. This was the first appearance of Munchlax and Bonsly. They were pre-evolutions of Snorlax and Sudowoodo, respectively, that would later be seen in Generation 4. I liked Gale of Darkness a lot. You had an Eevee that you could... I mean, I remember evolving my Eevee into an Espeon or an Umbreon. I can't remember which. But could you also get one of the Elemental Stones and have a Jolteon, Flareon, or Vaporeon in XD?
I think.
I wanted to see you
it's
can.
It's been years. I think that you can, but it's been years since I played that game.
Because, of course, Eevee, for those of you who don't know, is the normal type, adorable little fox type Pokemon.
I effing hate Eevees.
Really?
Because of you playing the Pokemon card game, I hate Eevees now.
Oh, I have a deck with, like, a Glaceon and a an Espeon, but Eevee's kind of one that people look forward to in each generation because...
It's a cute little fox.
It's a cute little fox that can evolve with the different elemental stones, and then, like, day and night, happiness, such and such. So, yeah, so you got to be an Eevee trainer in XD. And I liked it. You know, I do recognize, yes, it wasn't a full-fledged Pokemon experience, but I liked it. You liked it too, didn't you?
Yeah, I effing love that game. I thought the story was great. I actually love the whole mechanic of, like, catching dark Pokemon and purifying them. I thought all of the modeling of the Pokemon themselves looked superb. Mm-hmm. The art assets, I thought it was just a beautiful game. I thought that it actually looked better than most of its contemporaneous PlayStation 2 JRPG competition. So,
yeah.
I really, really, really enjoyed that game.
Well, I mean, I think it, any day of the week that most GameCube games look better than PS2 games. Just saying. GameCube for life. In November of 2005, in Japan, and then later in 2006, September 2006 in North America, November 2006 in Europe, was Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, Red Rescue Team and Blue Rescue Team, respectively for the Game Boy Advance, for Red Rescue Team, and the DS for Blue Rescue Team. This, of course, was developed by Toonsoft, who, you know, made the Mystery Dungeon series. What's it called in Japan? The Mystery Dungeon? Just in general? I thought they had a specific mystery, like a specific Japanese name.
Do you just mean, like, Fushigi no Dungeon?
Yeah.
Like, that's mystery, like, Dungeon of Mystery.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I was looking at you like, I beg your pardon.
So, this was kind of neat because, unlike, you know, Red, Blue, Gold, Silver, Ruby, Sapphire, this split between the Game Boy Advance and DS, the two versions. They're basically the same game. Blue takes advantage of the dual screens for, you know, various features. And it's, you know, it's a mystery dungeon game. You're a human that gets turned into a Pokemon. Now, I'm not familiar with a lot of the other mystery dungeon games, I have to admit. Is that part of the mystery dungeon theme where you're a human that gets turned into a non-human?
Like no.
A Chocobo mystery dungeon? Okay, so that's something that's unique for the Pokemon mystery dungeon, then, it seems.
Yes.
You had to take a personality quiz that could give you one of 16 results, and you talk with your Poke friends and do mystery dungeon stuff. Did you play Red Rescue Team, Blue Rescue Team, or did you jump in later with
Mystery Dungeon? I jumped in with the next set of Mystery Dungeon games.
So I can't really speak to Red Rescue Team, Blue Rescue Team, but I always thought it was kind of cool that they were split across the two handhelds that, you know, were still both selling well at that time. Well, you know, DS was new, but Game Boy Advance got included in on that as well. In December of 2004 in Japan, in March 2005 for Europe and North America, Europe getting it a few days earlier, is Pokemon Dash, developed by Umbrella. It was a racing game involving control with your stylus. If you were playing as one-player mode, you could only race as Pikachu. If you had a third-generation Game Boy Advance game in your GBA slot in your DS, you could race on a track shaped like one of the Pokemon from your team. This game got really negative reviews. I'm wanting to say that, like, I never owned it, but I feel like I played it once and was not a fan. Did you ever play Dash? My original notes for the show mentioned it as being like a total shit show, but then I changed that to received very negative reviews, but I remember it being a fucking mess from what little I played.
You know, the thing is, this was an early DS title, and I bought all of the old DS games. Like, that's my thing. I've talked about it here on the show. Typically, when a new console comes out, I buy tons of games. So I bought Pokemon Dash, because it was a Pokemon game. And it's fucking awful. I'm sorry, I should have said that like Kelly. And it sucked!
Ah! You know, I just realized that I kind of talked about Mystery Dungeon out of order. That actually came a little bit later. But, oh well, we talked about Mystery Dungeon. So, whatever. if you're out there who likes Pokemon Dash, please tell us what you like about it. We're not trying to be mean, but I just was not a fan. You know, I guess the whole idea of a Pokemon racing game is a little silly, but I would have rather had Pokemon Kart with Pokemon driving carts, you know? I remember, actually, I think I remember, like, disliking Dash so much that I, like, had a, like, design document draft for, like, a Pokemon Kart game. I don't know if I ever told you that. I knew you at this time, but I don't know if I ever told you that.
I don't think you did.
Probably because I was a little bit embarrassed about it. In October 2005 in Japan, March 2006 in North America, May 2006 in Europe, was Pokemon Trozdae. It is a puzzle game developed by Genius Sonority, who did the XD and Colosseum games for GameCube. It's kind of a spiritual successor to Yoshi's Cookie, is the best way to put it. Do you have another way to describe Trozdae?
Dull?
Yeah. Yoshi's Cookie.
I like Genius Sonority a lot, but I just didn't think Trozdae was very good.
Yeah, Yoshi's Cookie.
I like Yoshi's Cookie, though, because I love cookies, and I love Yoshi.
Yoshi's Cookie, this isn't Puzzle Buoy today, so. One game that was really, I think, kind of the first spinoff that kind of grew into its own big thing, you know, because, you know, Mystery Dungeon was the Fushigi no Dungeon series by Junsoft, but,
yeah.
In March 2006 in Japan, October 2006 in North America, April 2007 in Europe, came Pokemon Ranger, developed by HAL Laboratory. It introduced the Fior region, and it was an RPG where you kind of temporarily capture Pokemon using a capture styler, which is basically your stylus using the touchscreen. Your only permanent companion is, if you're a female character, it's a Plusle, or if you're a male character, a Minun, which were the third generation little electric rodents that were basically Pikachu, Pichu, with little charges, like pluses or minuses, to be like battery charges. And yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's the whole thing like, oh, which Pikachu clone are they entitled with this generation? Plusle and Minun were kind of reductive, but one thing that was really cool about Ranger is that it had a Manaphy egg that you can unlock, and that would let you later on transfer it to Diamond, Pearl, and Platinum, and, you know, Diamond and Pearl were still 6 months away from release, so it was really forward-thinking of, you know, including those for, you know, being different than something like, oh, a Bonsly is in XD. It's not like you could take the Bonsly and put it in the game. But the Manaphy was designed to be transferred to Diamond and Pearl, so, you know, kind of being like, hey, if you got Pokemon Ranger, you're going to want to buy Diamond and Pearl so you can use this cool new Manaphy egg. I actually have not spent a lot of time with any of the Ranger games. Have you?
I did with that first one just for, you know, Manaphy, but since then, no.
What were your thoughts on them? Because I don't think I've really ever played a full one.
Honestly, I didn't like it. And that's kind of why I haven't really been buying them since then. It's just something about it. It doesn't really click for me. It's very basic.
Well, you know, HAL isn't doing them anymore. So I wonder if some of the newer ones would be more appealing to you. But
maybe.
Anyway, so that was the official end of the third generation was Pokemon Ranger, kind of with this Manaphy egg leading up. And with that came the fourth generation with Pokemon Diamond and Pearl. And, I mean, I really remember this being the first generation that you and I played together. Because, you know, with Ruby and Sapphire, that was, I think, a little bit before we knew each other. But so I remember, I think we went out on March 22nd, 2007. I think we both went to the store and picked up Diamond and Pearl. I got Diamond, you got Pearl. I definitely remember that. It came out in Japan in September of 2006, and then July 2007 in Europe. It introduced 107 new Pokemon in the land of Sinnoh. Of course, with the DS, this introduced Wi-Fi, which was a big game changer. It kind of brought back the times of day, but I don't remember it being so, like, punitive.
Yeah, it was there, and it was an element, but it wasn't
as exclusive.
I
feel like it was more, like, Pokemon are more common at that time of day.
It was, yeah, it was like, oh yeah, at this time of day, there will be more Drifloons in this area.
But
and less, like, you cannot catch this.
Right, which I think is a much more effective way to do that. One of the big changes, battle-wise, was that physical and special attack were changed from being based on the elemental types to based on the moves. So, physical and special were stats that were, attack and special, rather, were changed from, originally, if it was like electric, water, fire, grass, those were special type moves. Like, regardless, those Pokemon were special, so you had a water and ice Pokemon, you probably want a high special stat. Fighting and rock and some of the kind of grittier ones, I guess you could say, were attack stats. But they changed it, which makes a lot of sense. To be, if you have a move that actually involves physical contact, like a headbutt, it's a physical attack.
Yeah, I actually find this to be way more intuitive.
If you have something where it's like a water gun where you're standing away, I mean, I kind of think of it as melee and ranged combat in an RPG. It's the best way to think of it. So I think it really, like you said, make it more intuitive and kind of means that, oh, you know, if you have something like a Torchic, Combusken, Blaziken, sorry. If you have a Blaziken, and you know, he has a little bit higher attack stat, that might help with his, like, Blaze Kick or something.
Yeah.
So I really kind of took it away from, oh, well, this Pokemon, is a water type, but has a low special, it's useless. Being like, no, like, teach it some moves that are based on physical attack, and, you know, it could be a real powerhouse.
So yeah,
I
absolutely.
Really think it was really positive change. I liked Diamond and Pearl quite a bit. Like I said, I remember playing with you kind of contemporaneously, you know. And that was a big deal for me because aside from high school, that was really the first time I had people to play with again, which is why I didn't double dip for Diamond and Pearl.
Yeah, I actually was in a relationship when this game came out with someone else whom I switched on to Pokemon. And we played these Pokemon games so much. So, I'm a big fan of this generation of Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, from the first gen, I was a huge Poke nerd during first gen. But I sort of fell out of it in the subsequent gens, largely because of, the day-night snafu in Gold Silver. And, you know, I still hung around. I still played the spin-offs. I still played the main games. But I wasn't into them with that real fervor. I would say the fervor came back all writ large with these two games, with Diamond and Pearl. Like, it was on, like, Donkey Kong, back to the old days. I was all about Pokemon again for the first time in years. Like, all about Pokemon.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it was very special because I didn't have to hide my Pokemania anymore.
That is just so sad to me.
Well, we'll talk about it on Game Buoy Advance. yeah, I really like Diamond and Pearl. I don't have too much to say about it. It didn't have as many changes, but I mean, I think the Wi-Fi, I mean, was really, I mean, a huge game changer. So, you know, even though it didn't add, like, you know, abilities or natures, that in itself, I mean, I think that was the first one with Pokemon contests, maybe, but I never really bought into that. But it's cool that there's those other ways of playing, you know? So, I mean, I guess that's cool in that way. Do you remember who your starter was for?
What were the starters in that generation?
So there was Turtwig, was the one that I chose. Crap, who were the other ones? Turtwig, I feel like there was a, Chimchar. There was Fire Monkey and Piplup.
And Piplup. I had Chimchar because my partner had
Piplup. Piplup. Yeah.
He did the cutest little, Pokemon call for that. It was like,
yeah.
And you had a Turtwig, right?
Yeah, so I think that's the reason we each chose a different starter.
Yeah, so that was great. And I loved that generation of Pokemon. I don't really remember what my Chimchar was named. It was probably just like Chimmy or maybe Flamin' Poops.
Well, I mean, he had a little fire on his butt. And like we talked about in the Poops episode, like a little like fiery poop on top of his head.
Yeah, he had fiery poops on his head.
After Diamond and Pearl, for the Wii, because this was the generation of the wildly successful Wii, in December 2006 in Japan, June 2007 in North America, December 2007 in Europe, was Pokemon Battle Revolution, which was a Genius Sonority game that was returned to the stadium type game. No story mode. This was the one that you said a lot of people got pissed at because there was no...
Yeah, there was a lot of negativity about this game. Because
I actually
it was
never
just
had Battle Revolution.
It's just the battle simulation. There's, like, nothing really else to it at all.
Well, I mean, especially with Colosseum, like, introducing that story mode, it really was, like, a step backwards. I didn't have Battle Revolution because at this point I'm like, you know, I'm going to battle on my DS. There's really no point. I think part of the appeal back in the day with Stadium for the N64 is that it was a huge jump forward visually, but, you know, with the games looking better and better each generation, you know, there's really was no need for a extra experience to battle at home. In December of 2006, in Japan only, was Pokémate. This was developed by Square Enix. It was for Docomo phones, actually. It was a mobile game for Docomo, and I'm surprised you're not singing.
To the Docomo.
It was kind of like
we'll take your Poke's gonna take it slow.
It was more like a virtual pet simulator thing. There was no battling. There were chat functions. This is one that people probably don't know a lot about. I didn't know about it really until I was researching for this episode, honestly. You could use microtransactions to increase, like, the number of Pokemon slots or Pokemon captures you could have in a month or something. So there were free and subscriber-based models.
Free-to-play Pokemon game!
Yeah, I mean, this was back before, you know, smartphones really were a huge thing, I feel so.
I want Pokemate now.
It would be interesting to see a, like, Pokemate XY.
I wonder if there are Pokemate emulators.
I wonder, huh. In 2007... September of 2007, in fact, in Japan, came Mystery Dungeon, Explorers of Time, and Explorers of Darkness. Came out in June 2008 in North America, July 2008 in Europe. Once again, by Chunsoft, of course. My understanding is that it's more of an emphasis on exploring rather than rescuing, because the Red Rescue Team, Blue Rescue Team are about, like, oh, gotta rescue your Pokemon friends. So, it sounds like more of a traditional Fushigi no Dungeon experience.
And, you know, this is the one that I played and got really into. I actually thought that this was a superb introduction to the Fushigi no Dungeon series. And even to, like, roguelikes as a genre, I think for a lot of people this would probably be, like, a really great first stepping stone into that, that sort of genre.
That's great. In Japanese arcades in November of 2007 came Pokemon Batrio. It was made by Takara Tomy and AQ Interactive, who, you know, at this point has been absorbed by Marvelous.
Marvelous!
It involved moving around pucks on a grid. You got these, like, little pog-like pucks in random packs that you would actually insert into the arcade, as I understand it. And you could buy a 600 yen save machine that would let you save, like, your character profile, which I guess for me, connecting it would be, like, taking your, what's the DDR clone we talked about, where you put the USB stick in and
Oh gosh, are you talking about In the Groove?
In the Groove, yeah. So that kind of what that made me think of, like taking your profile home. But I guess like even like Initial D games have like a little card and stuff.
Well, I mean,
right?
If you look back even to like Neo Geo games used to have that on some of the AES systems way back in, you know, the '90s. So this is not like an all new technology.
We could do a little micro about that. That'd be cute.
What, arcade save cards? Come on now, you're mining. You're really trying real hard to get blood from a turnip.
So, in 2008, in various regions, March in Japan, November in North America, Europe, came Pokemon Ranger Shadows of Almia. And this was not done by HAL Laboratory. This was done by Creatures, Inc., who, you know, we talked about way earlier in the discussion about kind of bailing out Game Freak when they were about to go bankrupt. Capturing was changed where you had to fill up a friendship gauge and introduce quests. So, you know, Shadows of Almia might be more up your alley.
Maybe, yeah. It sounds pretty neat.
My Pokemon Ranch was a WiiWare title.
This is the one I was thinking about earlier when you were talking about PokePark.
Yeah, it was a WiiWare title, so it was a little cheapy. March in Japan, June and July in North America and Europe, respectively.
Of 2008.
It was developed by Umbrella, and it was kind of Pokemon Box again. So another kind of prelude to Pokemon Bank. Mm-hmm. It lets you kind of interact with your Pokemon with your Mii. So, you know, it's the era of the Mii and the Wii. So, you know, Mii implementation into every damn thing. But that's kind of cute. I never had it, but sounds cute. In September 2008 in Japan, March 2009 in North America, so we're real quickly catching up to the modern age now. In May 2009 in Europe was Pokemon Platinum. You know, it's the third entry, kind of the revamped one. I think there was, in some plot changes. There was Giratina had a new form.
As did Shaymin and Rotom.
Shaymin and Rotom. One thing that I feel like the DS ones kind of started to introduce were new forms, although Jirachi might have had different forms in the Game Boy Advance one. I'm not sure. But, like, form with it, it was spelled F-O-R-M-E, so it was, like, battle form, a defense form. So that was really something kind of neat where, I guess depending on what version you had or certain conditions, the form would be different. And that could affect stats, so that was kind of cool. You were able to get the Legendary Birds Trio from the original games in Platinum. You were able to get Regice, Regirock, and Registeel. I guess the Regie Trio is kind of what they're called. Their bodies were ready. Another thing was the Wi-Fi Plaza, which lets you play mini-games with up to 20 players. Now, my understanding is that it's the Plaza can hold up to 20. I don't know if every mini-game allows for 20.
I thought that they all could play. I mean, I've never really experimented with that.
But. I played Platinum, but I didn't do anything with the Wi-Fi Plaza. Did you have Platinum?
I did not, but I'm thinking about it now. I kind of really want to get this game. I didn't know it, but it had Articuno, Zapdos, and Moltres in it. So that'd probably be my easiest way of getting a Articuno into X and Y without replaying a game I just played.
Yeah.
Using Pokebank, yeah.
Pokemon Bank, sorry.
Because Pokebank is going to be live in just another couple weeks now.
Yep. In April of 2009, Japan, October 2009, North America, and November 2009 in Europe. So you notice these game release windows getting a lot closer. Pokemon Mystery Dungeons Explorer of Sky from Chunsoft. It expanded the plot from Explorers of Time, Explorers of Darkness, and it could be 5 new types of Pokemon, so cute. Did you play Sky or just Time or Darkness?
I played Sky as well, and I really liked it. Like, I thought it was really good.
Was there anything that you would say was notable besides the expanded plot?
You know, there was more Pokemon in it. Those are sort of the two real things I really remember.
Those were the two points that I would mention too. In 2009 came Pokemon Rumble, which was a WiiWare title. It was June in Japan, and then November for the Western regions. It was known as Melee Pokemon Scramble in Japan. It was developed by Umbrella, so, you know, kind of coming a long way from those Pika Sims with AU Pikachu.
Yeah.
It was it's a real-time Melee linear dungeon sort of game. It's, of course, the prelude to Rumble U, which we've talked about here on air. I never played original Rumble, but my understanding is that all of the Rumble games kind of have that little, like, toy Pokemon.
That is my understanding, yeah.
Art asset, which I think is adorable. Also in 2009, in Japan only, in August of 2009, was a WiiWare trilogy of titles. Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, Keep Going, Blazing Adventure Squad. Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, Let's Go, Stormy Adventure Squad. Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, Go For It, Light Adventure Squad. They were all, of course, by Chunsoft. Something that sounds kind of cool about this is that Wii Connect 24 would add missions to your game while your Wii's asleep, and that you could save data through all three games on your Wii. So it's kind of a shame that this one never got a domestic release, and I don't really know why.
I was actually really upset at the time when this didn't get brought over because, you know, again, I became a fan of this series around this time, and I was very, very disappointed that this new iteration that seemed to have a lot of new features didn't make it over. And as a WiiWare title, it wasn't like I could just import it.
Yeah, and so now you notice we're getting, even though I say closer to the modern time, but this is almost 5 years ago still, so, gosh. A lot of these titles we're going to be...
Well, speed it up, Princess. We're in 2.5 hours.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. A lot of these, we're going to have less and less to say. For example, in 2009, in September 2009 in Japan, March 2010 North America and Europe, was Heart Gold and Soul Silver. Predictably, these are remakes of Gold and Silver. The only real difference is that your first Pokemon in your party will follow you, kind of like Pikachu did in Yellow. Which, I mean, is since then, they haven't had it really in the later games since then, so I don't know why they only did that in Heart Gold Soul Silver, just to sell it, I guess. It came with the Pokewalker, which was a little Pokeball pedometer sort of thing, and then it let you kind of capture Pokemon and transfer them into your game. It was kind of like a, I want to say, infrared sort of transfer.
Yeah, it was. And I actually had it, you know, I used it. I didn't think it was really incredible, but it was something all right.
I tried to get, because there were, I think, flying and surfing Pikachus that you could get, but I didn't get them, and I was pissed. And that was the end of the Pokewalker. But, the 3DS has the step counter and the play coin, so kind of perhaps a prelude to that. In December 2009 in Japan, July 2010 in Europe, and November 2010 in North America, for the Wii, was Poke Park Wii, Pikachu's Adventure. It was by Creatures, Inc., and it was mini-games. I never played it. It looked kind of derpy.
Yeah.
In 2010, on the DS, came Pokemon Ranger Guardian Signs. And at this point, because the release windows are getting so close, I'm not even going to really bother saying the different release windows anymore.
Okay.
Apparently you could call out Pokemon for support. You could use Guardian Signs to summon legendaries, and there was 4-player co-op play. So
that's neat.
That might be a cool one to check out, because I think that's the most recent Ranger.
Yeah, maybe I'll look into that then.
Yeah, me too. And with that, with Generation 5 was kind of a surprise for people, because it was the first time that there were two generations on the same handheld, this, of course, being the DS. And that was Pokemon Black and White, which came out 2010-2011, within a couple of months span. It added 156 new Pokemon in the land of Unova. One of the big quality-of-life changes for me was that TMs, for those who don't know, TMs are short for technical machines. There's also hidden machines, HMs. Are moves that you get from around in the world and also from gym leaders. TMs, up until that point, were consumable. You had to choose what Pokemon you wanted, teach it to. HMs were reusable, but you have to, up until a certain game, added the move deleter. It's the only way to get rid of it. And it's still the case for HMs, but Black and White let you reuse TMs, and I'm so glad, because there's certain moves like Flamethrower, Thunderbolt, and Ice Beam, which I think are some of the like signature moves that I prefer over the less accurate but more powerful moves, Thunder, Fire Blast, and Blizzard.
Something I really want to point out about Unova, the setting of these games, is because, you know, I like it very much. It's actually based on New York City.
Oh, that's right. So we did have a...
This might have been
the generation that introduced the trash Pokemon.
Oh!
There's a trash Pokemon. I don't remember his name.
You're right.
Because at this point, we were up to, I think, 649 was the number that I associate with Generation
of the 5. Number of Pokemon, you mean.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And then now it's like, I don't even know.
Yeah, I guess we didn't get any, like, French fry Pokemon or cigarette butt Pokemon.
There was Vanilla Ice, which was an ice cream.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was Vanilla Ice as a Pokemon.
One thing that was kind of cool was Seasons, and they might have taken some experience from the Time of Day issues by making the seasons change each month. So I guess if you, like, went away to boarding school or something and couldn't bring your DS, I don't know. But it changed each month in the land of Unova, so I thought that was kind of neat. And, you know, also, there was, like, a Pokemon called Sazbuck, which was a deer, a grass-type deer, and his form changed based on the different times of the visual appearance. I don't think there was any actual stat changes, but his visual appearance changed, so that was kind of cute. In 2011 in Japan, 2012 in Europe, was Learn with Pokemon, Typing Adventure. It was a Genius Sonority game that you captured Pokemon by typing. So I'm guessing it's kind of a Typing of the Dead. It was bundled with a wireless keyboard, and, you know, it seems like LOL trash game, but thinking of it like Typing of the Dead, but Pokemon, I kind of wish that we had gotten a release in North America. I wonder if this is easy to import. You should look into that, Captain Spike.
Yeah, I will.
In 2011, for the 3DS, so now in the era of the 3DS, was Pokemon Rumble Blast. It was also known as Super Pokemon Scramble, if you were in Japan. Of course, it was developed by Umbrella. It was the successor to Rumble, and it allowed you to Street Pass. I didn't play Rumble Blast, so I don't have too much to say about it. In 2011-2012 came PokePark 2, Wonders Beyond, for the Wii. It was a sequel to PokePark Wii. My understanding is that this Creatures Inc. game involved more mini games. There's some like battle-y things you could do, 4-player multiplayer, but
sounds like a shit show.
Kinda does. If you're a fan of the PokePark series, please let us know. We'd be very interested to see, because, you know, I kind of feel like these Umbrella games have kind of been really marketed to younger kids, like pre-able to think. And now we're, you know, starting to catch up to the Game Boy era and games that we've talked about on air. In 2012 came Pokemon Conquest for the DS, which of course was known in Japan as Pokemon plus Nobunaga's Ambition, which of course is a crossover with Pokemon and Nobunaga's Ambition. Of course, developed by Tecmo Koei. And, of course, was a turn-based strategy tactical RPG.
And, you know, this, much like the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games, I think that the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games are a great introduction to roguelikes for, you know, kids or people who don't have experience or what have you. To me, Conquest is, like, the perfect introduction to tactics-style strategy gaming. Sort of single-unit versus single-unit strategy games.
You got your nephew into Conquest?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And now your nephew's all into, like, tactics and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. I liked Conquest, but, you know, I think now that Fire Emblem Awakening is out and has, like, you know, different difficulty modes, I'd recommend that, honestly. But this isn't Fire Emblem Bowie. But, you know, if you have a youngster who's, you know, you want to kind of expose to the turn-based strategy genre, and they like Pokemon, you know, great way to get them in. Now, a first for the Pokemon franchise was the release of Black 2 and White 2 last year. And, you know, like we said, this is kind of notable because instead of a Pokemon Gray, which was what a lot of people were assuming because it's a mixture of black and white, they instead chose to make a straight-up sequel to Black and White. You know, they made some changes to the overworld map, that were reflected in the story. So, you know, some areas were, like, frozen over by, like, a climate change. I actually haven't finished my copy of White 2.
Yeah, I have a Black 2, and I have not finished it yet either. It's really cool, though. What I played of it, I really like.
Yeah, I mean, I think just because it's more of the same, I was a little less inclined to power through.
Yeah.
And this was the one we had mentioned earlier, much earlier in this episode, the Pokemon Dream Radar. It's an AR game for your 3DS.
Where you can send some Pokemon into the internet, and it grows in Dreamland.
I'm sorry, wait, I said 3DS. But so AR games were only 3DS, right? I'm confused right now.
Yeah, no, this was not the AR game. This was the one where you sent them out into the internet.
Really? Because AR game was where you, like, put it around in the room and...
Yeah, that was not...
That wasn't Dream Raider? I somewhere in my research I got confused then, because...
Oh, no, I'm mixing it up. This is, yeah, no, Dream Radar was the 3DS app that you could download.
Right, thank you. So I was getting confused.
That interplays with Black 2 and White 2.
Yeah, so Black 2, White 2, to be clear, is a DS game, but if you're playing it on 3DS, which at this point we both were, you could go into Pokemon Dream Radar and capture Pokemon. And my understanding is that there's some pretty, like, rare-ish Pokemon that you can get, so... You know, and my understanding is that it's still available, so I kind of think I should look into this.
And what I was thinking about was the Pokemon Dream World, not Dream
Radar.
Yeah,
so, you know, when you were saying the internet thing, I remember that, too. But I don't know, what was Dream World?
So Dream World was basically a thing where during Generation 5, it was sort of like the analog to the Pokewalker. You would send your Pokemon to the internet. And then you'd log back into the internet, like, a day or two later, and they would have new items, and sometimes they would have other Pokemon that made friends with them and came back to your game.
Aww, that's cute.
And many of the Pokemon that you could find there were Pokemon that you couldn't find in Unova. They were Pokemon largely that came from Generation 4.
Hmm.
And all of the Pokemon... They would come with hidden abilities that, obviously, you know, hidden abilities were a big deal because they were abilities that you otherwise wouldn't get from Pokemon caught in the wild.
Right. So, yeah, like, I don't think Black 2 and White 2 were bad by any means. And, you know, kind of interesting to think that is a sequel necessary for those games? Is a third version necessary for those games? You know, I think both are welcome, but, you know, kind of be interesting to see if we have X2, Y2, or Pokemon Z. I think people are anticipating either one of those being a possibility. Very recently, you know, just this year, we talked about it, so was Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Gates to Infinity came out at the end of last year in Japan, a couple months later. You know, just earlier this year, we talked about it here on Game Buoy.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's a demo available on the 3DS eShop.
This is, of course, a 3DS title. It is by Spike Chunsoft, because at this point, Spike and Chunsoft had merged. It's kind of cute because it lets you use your 3DS camera to find round objects and turn them into portals called Magna Gates. And these are in-game, there's an in-game explanation for it. The AR object, there are AR options that let you scan real-world objects to unlock dungeons. I played the demo of it. It seemed pretty cool. But my understanding is that it didn't review super well compared to the past Mystery Dungeons.
Yeah, well, it's a bit watered down. They sort of took out or simplified a lot of the mechanics in the game. So it's a bit dull. It's a bit dull.
Mm.
I still like it. It's beautiful, but, ugh.
Yeah. And earlier this year, Generation 5, and because, you know, at this point, we had heard the announcement of X and Y, so earlier this year, Generation 5 came to an end with Pokemon Rumble U, or Scramble U in Japan, which is a Wii U eShop title developed by Umbrella. You know, it's based on the other Rumble games, but the focus is more on a battle arena than, like, a, you know, specifically, like, dungeons that you're going through. And, of course, like we talked about here on air, the NFC toys are GameStop exclusives here in the U.S. So, you've played Rumble, you talked about it on air, you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, To some degree, it has to be said, you know, it's very simplistic and almost feels primarily like a gimmick to sell the little Pokemon NFC toys.
Yeah, which we thought were going to kind of, between that and Infinity...
Disney Infinity.
Disney Infinity, yeah, that's what I meant. Oust Skylanders, but, you know, we just talked last week about Skylanders.
Skylanders is still huge, although Infinity is also huge.
Yeah, but Pokemon Rumble,
U is not huge at all.
And I have to wonder if it's because it's that GameStop exclusive, but...
Well, yeah, and also the fact that the game is basic as shit. I mean, I like it. It's fun, but it's a little diversion. It's not like a serious, super fun game or anything.
Yeah. And now here we are in Generation 6 of Pokemon, which only has one game to speak of. That is, of course, Pokemon X and Y for the 3DS, which came out worldwide on October 12th. So, you know, just a little over a month ago. We wanted to, you know, kind of get a chance to really dive into the game before having this episode, so, you know... That's why we're looking at it about a month and a half later. I'm going to just list off a couple of important points, and then we'll talk about the game. So it had a worldwide simultaneous release. 69, hey, new Pokemon. 3D models. Oh, so that new total is 718. So, yep, that was 649 for the previous generation.
Okay.
3D models, as we've talked about. Mega Evolution. Pokemon Ami. Super Training. OMG, clothes. Fairy type Pokemon. And, you know, something that's very notable is that so far this is the fastest selling 3DS title to date. It sold 4 million copies in its first weekend because, you know, it's just come out. We're going to kind of have to wait and see, you know, kind of at the end of this quarter of the fiscal year to kind of see how much it did in the its first quarter of sales. But, you know, it's a record-breaking title, and you know, I think it really speaks to the fact that this is still, like, Pokemon games are events, like you said. I don't really feel like I need to talk too much about, oh, fairy types, or, oh, Pokemon Ami, because we kind of talked about that during What's Ups and stuff. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sort of at a bit of a crossroad here, because I'd really like to talk about Pokemon X and Y. I think that it's definitely a Game of the Year contender for me. Incredible game, absolutely adored it, loved it, but I have talked about it on the show quite a bit already.
Right, so, I mean, it really feels like a step forward, and, I mean, I guess we'll kind of look back at the series up to this point to wrap up our discussion in a bit, but, yeah, we don't really have too much to say right now because, you know, we have talked about it so much on air, and it is the start of the new generation, so... it's the first entry in Generation 6. There's nothing really official game-wise that has been, you know, release date announced and such, so we're going to have to see what comes of the new generation of Pokemon. So at this point, I want to take a few minutes to talk about kind of the legacy of Pokemon, both in terms of the overall media franchise and its impact on the industry and kind of Nintendo and... Game Freak, what it's allowed them to do. So, I want to talk about the media franchise first. I kind of want to think about back in the late 90s, the later half of the 90s, that the state of the toy industry was kind of really about, like, oh, collectible things. And I guess, arguably, there's always been a collectible things trend in toys. But, I mean, I'm really thinking about, like, Tamagotchi, Beanie Babies. Like, really kind of was... Pokemon kind of tapped into this marketing zeitgeist at the time.
Well, and there was, in the zeitgeist with involving toys and collectibles, you know, there was like a real frenzy. You think about, like, even with things like Tickle Me Elmo and Furbies, there was like there was a real feeling going about right then about, again, like collecting and finding things. And Pokemon really distilled that. It really...
Well, Gotta Catch 'Em All really was...
Exactly. It tapped right into this sort of current of the zeitgeist.
Exactly.
And really exploited sort of this mentality that was very popular at this time period of collecting and collectibles and having amassing a collection. Pokemon really tapped into that in a way that very few games, I think, really can tap into sort of what's going on in the culture in the larger sense.
Yeah, so I would say, like, 98, 99 was the height of Pokemania. And, you know, earlier I mentioned it being similar to Beatlemania. Like, the thing is that although Pokemon has not dissolved as a franchise the way that the Beatles broke up as a band, you know, that the Beatles are still probably, like, the hugest musical group of all time. And Pokemon is one of the biggest gaming franchises of all time. But, you know, there was that 1964 Ed Sullivan, Hard Day's Night, She Loves You, yeah, 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 Beatles Mania. And I feel like that Pokemania really was that time during Generation 1. You think of all the controversies. There was the Electric Soldier Porygon episode, which was banned here because of the...
Pokemon seizures.
Yeah, 600-something seizures. You know, and we talk about, oh, yeah, we remember the seizure episode of Pokemon, but, like, The Simpsons spoofed it, and South Park spoofed Pokemon at this time, too, when South Park was just starting out. So, you know, it was definitely something that we were hearing about on the news, which... You know, video games was, at that point, still kind of a very a niche thing in a large way.
You know, it's funny. I have to say, I don't mean to make light of the Pokemon seizure incident, because I know that this was obviously very, very, very unpleasant for a lot of people, obviously, who suffered. But I almost feel like, in a way that could never have been intended, Pokemon and Nintendo and Pokemon as a brand... really benefited from exposure.
Pokemon seizure episode's kind of a meme, and I mean, really thinking in a pre-meme world, internet meme world, you know, it was really kind of like, oh, Pokemon seizures. So, no, I don't think that's insensitive to say, even though, you know, yes, it was very unfortunate. There were a lot of other controversies. I remember, if you remember Carol Boston Weatherford, the woman who had issues with Jinx, and you know, it's, you could be like, you know, yes, she thought that Jinx was a, you know, personification of the blackface iconography, which, you know, she had some validity, but, you know, it's kind of, I think, you know, depending on where you stand on it. But I think the thing that's significant about it is that Nintendo responded to that by changing Jinx's appearance. You know, Jinx is kind of like a sexy seductress, ice and psychic type. And they changed her from having, you know, a black face to having a purple hue in her face and reducing some of the potentially offensive iconography. So, I mean, I think that was kind of significant in that way, whether or not you necessarily thought that Carol Boston Weatherford was overreacting. There was also a lot of, you know... Anytime video games are involved, there's a lot of religious fervor over it. I mean, you think back to, like, D&D and those kind of hilarious, like, oh, it's the work of the devil, and, you know, we all are familiar with that, but, you know, there's also, like, oh, Pokemon evolution conflicts with my religious beliefs, and so the church is banning Pokemon, and then, you know, Pokemon cards being banned at school because it promoted gambling. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Were the cards banned at your high school?
You know, they weren't, but they were pretty new still at that time.
That's true. And then, I don't know if you remember this one. This one was one I had forgotten about until I did my research again for this episode. There was a card in the TCG called Koga's Ninja Trick. Koga was the poison gym leader.
Uh-huh.
And it had a manji on it. Now, the manji, for big Nintendo nerds, might be familiar... most by being the symbol that is represented in Dungeon 3 of the original Legend of Zelda. It's in the shape of a manji.
Oh, God. Is that really what you're going to connect the manji to? Because
can you explain it? Because I'm not too familiar with the manji. Well, of course, this manji looks kind of like a mirror image swastika. So there was a lot of controversy, and I think that card got pulled from Western distribution. I wanted to say, is the manji like a Buddhist symbol, or...
Hinduism,
okay. I would have thought Buddhist because, you know, I don't think there's a lot of Hinduism in Japan, but...
Yeah, the manji has its roots in Buddhism, known as the Yungdrung in ancient Tibet. It was a graphical representation of eternity, which is, of course, why in the pre-Nazi days it had come over to Western cultures as, like, a good luck symbol.
Yeah, and, like... You know, not to get turned into a history lesson, but I think even, ironically, Judaism used it as a good luck symbol, or, you know, certain, you know, Jewish societies or something, I want to say. But this isn't history, Bowie. But thank you for that quick explanation on the manji, which people might not be familiar with.
I'll be honest, I mostly know about it from the manga Blade of the Immortal.
Ah.
Which has its own interesting localization issues, since most manga, you know, they in the time period would mirror for its U.S. release, and obviously they couldn't mirror the manji, because then it would look like a swastika.
Yeah. So,
in any event, continue, we are not Blade of the Immortal Bowie.
And we're not manji Bowie. And we're certainly not swastika Bowie. But of course, really what we think of with this media franchise are the toys, the video games, the anime and movies, and the trading card game that really, like, you know, made this huge media franchise that, you know, even though it maybe isn't still at the forefront of the entertainment industry, it's still successful. You know, at this point, it's been a couple of years since Pokemon Company took over the trading card game from Wizards of the Coast. But, you know, the anime is still going, still getting released over here. I'm going to give you a few quick stats out in Radioland. There have been 53 TCG sets, 55 in Japan, so there were two Japan-only ones. As of this recording tonight, there have been 812 episodes of the anime that in Japan are kind of split up into six main series to coincide with each generation. In Western parts of the world that look at seasons and stuff a little differently, this equates to 17 seasons, so I can't say for sure, but possibly longest running anime?
No way.
Dragon Ball?
Dragon Ball was what, like, not even? But stuff like Doraemon.
Oh, okay.
Like, there are shows.
But
that
still
have
longer than, like, Naruto or.
Oh, heavens, yes.
Yeah. Which we still think of as, like, long running. So, I mean, one of the longest running anime of all time. And there have been 16 movies, kind of one to go with each season so far. You know, if we think of it in terms of, like, American seasons. And, you know, we've talked about kind of I think of all of these, the TCG is the only one that, and that's only been just this past month that we've gotten back into. I have no real interest in the anime anymore, personally.
I'm open to watching some of the movies.
Although,
I liked Pokemon The Origin a lot. You know, I hear that some of the more recent Mewtwo movie stuff has been pretty good.
Yeah, so like you said, Pokemon The Origin, which was the OVA, was really good. And, you know, kind of dark at some point. So, you know, the thing is that definitely both in Japan and throughout the world, still a huge deal, still an event when each game is released. Before we wrap this up and look at the future and kind of looking back, I just want to talk about the impact it's had on the gaming industry and also kind of on Nintendo and Game Freak. I think that Pokemon really kind of innovated in the way that we think of game communicating with each other. You know, when we
I
think
definitely
of the,
strongly agree there.
I think when we think of the Link Cable, it's like, you know, oh, battling in Tetris, but, you know, I would argue that without Pokemon, you know, there would not be all these creative ideas about how games communicate. Now, with the internet, of course, making that a lot easier. And something else I kind of want to think about is that really the only comparable game I can think of prior to Pokemon was Shin Megami Tensei, which, you know, involves working with demons and stuff. And after Pokemon came out, there was a surge of Pokeclones, and I can't really speak to the development of these games as to whether they were a response to Pokemon or just kind of happened to coincide. The two big ones that I think of are Shin Megami Tensei Devil Children, which was known as Demi Kids here because, yeah, you can't release a game called Devil Children, and Dragon Quest Monsters. I didn't play Demi Kids, Devil Children. I believe you have, right?
Yes, I have.
Would you say that it was made in response to Pokemon?
Yes. I don't think that can be denied. Much like Dragon Quest Monsters, this is not a game that would exist without Pokemon, I don't think.
See, I thought I played only the first Dragon Quest Monsters for Game Boy Color. I thought it did some interesting things, and it was, I believe, right in between that first and second generation. So it was kind of a nice little like game to tide me over in between the generations. It did some different things. You know, with Dragon Quest, there were slimes, and there were some interesting things with breeding. For Demi Kids, Devil Children, how can you speak to it's what it took from Pokemon and what it did differently, unless you really didn't spend too much time with it?
You know, I didn't. Again, this was sort of that window where I was just starting working. I was just getting out of high school. It was a real transitory state in my life. So while I had the game and played it a little, I didn't really get super into it.
Yeah, and then, of course, we talked in our Pirate Games episode about Keitai Denju Telephane, which was pirated as Pokemon Diamond and Jade. And my understanding is that Telephane, in its actual form, is not a terrible game. And, you know, there's, I think, even to this day, still a push for a localization of it. So that's kind of interesting. Or, like, you know, even if it's just, like, a official translation or... I don't know, but I was reading up, I was like, oh, wow. There's still a small but devoted Telephane fandom. You know, a lot of these recent RPGs, such as Enchant Arms and Ni No Kuni, a lot of people say, oh, they're very Pokemon-like, even though, you know, in that regard, I'd say, you know, they owe just as much to Shin Megami Tensei in, like, the Persona games as they would to Pokemon. But particularly Ni No Kuni, I think, definitely with its family-friendly presentation, does kind of tap into the fact that, yeah, these monster collecting games do sell. And, you know, just looking at the numbers, Pokemon is the second best-selling game series in the world, second only to Mario, which, of course, is... That's why kind of we say people are like, eh, Nintendo, but Mario is the freaking best-selling franchise in gaming of all time. Of all time. And, you know, the latest number as per Nintendo was from the end of the fiscal year, earlier this year in March. Over 245 million games have been sold in the Pokemon series. So, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean...
huge numbers, like, unparalleled by anything but Mario, basically. And, of course, Mario includes Super Mario. I think that if you look at just the Super Mario games, that Pokemon does a little more, but Mario includes everything Mario. But I think, like, the third is, like, Super Mario, but... you know, Super Mario actually might even do more than Pokemon itself. But the point being that, yeah, Nintendo's got the highest-selling franchises of video games in the world, and Pokemon is the second best. And, you know, I mean, I think that's nothing to, you know, scoff at, because, like you said, these games are events. They're a huge deal, and, you know, even if you're like, oh, Pokemon's for kids... you know, I think it, especially these days, with gaming culture kind of being more something that's grown with the internet, there's a lot of people being like, yeah, I like freaking Pokemon, man. I'm an adult. We're, like, in our 30s, late 20s, early 30s, and no shame in liking fucking Pokemon. Fucking Pokemon, not fucking Pokemon. That's some Rule 34 stuff that we don't want to get into. Do you have anything that you'd like to say about the impact that it's had on the industry? I know that you were particularly interested in talking about kind of the freedom that it's given Game Freak to make some of these really creative and niche titles like Harmonite or your beloved Drilldozer.
Yeah, Drilldozer was an incredible game, and certainly you have to wonder if they would have had the pull to make a game, because, you know, this game, it was notable for having a Rumble cartridge before... like there was, because this was a GBA game with a Rumble cartridge. It involved extra tech in its cartridge. It was an expensive thing to make. You know, who knows if they would have had the pull to have launched that without, you know, the behemoth that was Pokemon under their belt.
Mm-hmm. And again, with Harmonite, which is just an eShop release, but still a cute little game, a nice little rhythm platformer that we mentioned in our rhythm gaming episode. And, you know, I mean, but I think the fact of the matter is that, by and large, Game Freak is the Pokemon studio. And, you know, I get the feeling that they're pretty much okay with that because, you know, they're still very passionate about it. You can tell that they still really put a lot of love and a lot of thought into these games. But, yeah, like you said, I mean, I think that's kind of something speaking to a larger trend in the, you know, gaming industry and in game development. If you have a best-selling franchise, you're probably going to be mostly making games with that IP. That's kind of just a matter of fact. I mean, you look at something like Crystal Dynamics and Tomb Raider. When have they made anything but Tomb Raider in the past whatever years? But, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. So, Any other thoughts about impact on the industry, on Nintendo?
No, I mean, you know, certainly I think that Nintendo's entire operating business over the last couple decades would look drastically different without, you know, the Pokemon foothold and the leverage that having this, you know, the two most successful gaming franchises of all time, that gives them a lot of power, a lot of sway, the ability to experiment. Because, you know, for all of the slack that Nintendo gets, sort of a big part of why they strike it rich so often, Pokemon, Mario, the Wii's success. I'm going to tie this all in and make it a Pokemon thing. But part of why they're so successful, I think, is because they do take risks. Pokemon itself could be seen as a risk. The way they launched this entire...
It was a huge risk. It almost bankrupt Game Freak.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly so. But, again, it paid dividends. It really worked out to their advantage.
Indeed. I really think that, like I said, that's nothing to scoff at. You know, and like you had mentioned yesterday that... the 3DS is just doing super well this month. And, I mean, I think that definitely Pokemon played a part in that. You know, kind of to compare, a lot of people on gaming journalism sites are like, oh, well, the Wii U hasn't seen an uptick of sales with Super Mario 3D World. But, you know, the Wii U is kind of its own beast. But, you know, this is something that I'm sure for a lot of people... Just like you mentioned back in the Pokemania days, with Space Pirate Ben's mom getting a Game Boy to play it.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people picked up a 3DS or 2DS who had been holding out even up until this point.
Without question. This is a game that sells... It sells consoles, it sells copies of itself, it sells, like, other media. Like, again, people got into this card game, and the game is good, don't get me wrong. But part of why it's so enduring is as much a part of the franchise and the property as it is the game mechanics.
And I think...
And you look at other spin-offs and spin-offs that aren't strictly Pokemon, something like Smash Brothers. Smash Brothers is certainly more popular for its inclusion of Pokemon than
right. Pikachu and Jigglypuff are like mainstays in the roster.
Oh yeah, you see them pop up in high-level play all the
Lucario.
Time.
Lucario.
Oh yeah, Lucario was huge in Brawl. Mm-hmm. So Pokemon went from sort of this weird risky idea from a little no-name studio that had previously only had success in Japan to being, I would say, one of sort of the most known properties across all media in the world. Like, not just video games. Like, Pokemon is like one of the big deals. You look at how Andy Warhol used to comment and talk a lot about how Mickey Mouse and Coca-Cola were iconography that you could recognize around the world.
Coca-Cola is the second most recognized word in the world.
You could go to other countries, and, you know, they might not know how to talk to you, but you ask them what Coca-Cola is, they know what Coca-Cola is.
Mickey Mouse, and same as Pokemon.
And that Pikachu certainly is on that level. Pokemon generally is on that level of recognition around the world. And I don't think you could really underestimate or overstate just how valuable and how incredible that is, considering its origins as a game, of how niche a game design that game would typically be considered to have been, especially when it released. I don't think you could possibly say enough about Pokemon as like a media empire almost.
And I think really the original Pokemon games really just tapped into this combination of, you know, kind of whimsicalness, cute characters, and, you know, just promoting kind of like that social interaction in gaming way before people started thinking about social media. I mean, this was pre-social media. Like, this was GeoCities days. This is the extent of the social media, really. News groups and such. But really thinking of interaction in games in a way that really was ahead of its time. I think that combination just really struck a chord with people. I mean, we talk about, oh, little Squirtle, the Squirtle, you know, and people form these emotional attachments to their Pokemon, too, more than you might form an attachment with your Cloud from your Final Fantasy VII save. And with that, I kind of want to look at the future and look at Pokemon Bank, because that specifically, Iwata-san and the folks over at Game Freak specifically referenced that in their introduction to Pokemon Bank. That, you know, people have these attachments that, you know, I talk about my Pidgeot from Pokemon Yellow and my original Pikachu. You talk about Squirty the Squirtle. We have these memories and these associations with these Pokemon that, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, I still have my my Sonic 3 save that was my special playthrough with Knuckles. It's like, so it's very rare, I think. I think the only other comparable emotional attachment people have with their Pokemon would be like a character in an MMO, which a lot of people feel very attached to. But, you know, Pokemon Bank really taps into that, and kind of also with the whole zeitgeist of cloud gaming. And if you're curious more about Pokemon Bank, which comes out Christmas Day in Japan, and then elsewhere 2 days later on December 27th, just a month from now, we are going to link you to an article over at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
It's a quick little blurb on IGN that explains the details.
LOL IGN.
Yeah, right. But so that's looking forward to the future. Like we said, Generation 6 is just getting started. But we don't really know too much about what's going to be happening. Aside from that, there's that Pokemon Detective game with the creepy mocap Pikachu laughing. That's going to be a 3DS game.
The blue Pikachu, right?
It's a Pika blue. Yeah, I was just saying that earlier. And then there's also that whole Pokken Fighters that hopefully will be something.
Pokken, yeah. I hope it is. I still really hope it is.
A lot of people are hoping that what the mystery IP that Abe-san is involved with is Pokken Fighters.
But that would be a good, because he has fighting game experience with Tekken. That would be a really good match.
That's why a lot
match.
Of people think that that might be what he's doing.
That would be a great match, man.
So, thank you all so much for putting up with us talking for nearly, 3 hours about Pokemon. I'm going to close out before we move on to our Poke social links by asking just a few questions.
We are half past the 3 hour mark.
Oh, wow. Well, that's typical for us. Captain Spike, I'm going to close this out by asking you a few questions. You know, I'm sure we both, you and I, hope that there are many more generations of Pokemon to come. So I want to ask you just a few quick questions. You'll answer, and then I'll answer. First question, do you think that the iterative design of the series, you know, just making a few changes each generation, has been successful, or do you think more should have been changed each generation?
I have two comments to say to that. And one, of course, is that for me, I personally find the iterative design to be extremely rewarding. I like it a lot. I really enjoy going through each generation and noting what's different and seeing how it's grown and changed. But I really like the core concepts of Pokemon. The whole, like, rock, paper, scissors style combat. You know, certainly I'm a big fan of JRPGs in the first place. Command battle JRPGs, as that specific type is now considered.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really enjoy it, but I do look at friends of mine, you know, people I've dated in the past who have been Pokemaniacs and fallen off after a generation, who have picked up, you know, oh, it's the new generation, I need to get it, and then they grab it, and then they're disappointed by how little has changed.
Mm.
So, I do think for some of us, it's perfectly fine. For me, personally, it's fine. It's superb.
Yeah,
I love
it. Yeah, you know, flip side to that, someone like Seawolf Jason, who only partook in the original generation and now got Pokemon X, I think he was really like, wow, so much has changed, and almost to a point where it was a little overwhelming. So I think for us, having followed the franchise over the past 15 plus years, we kind of think that, you know, it's more iterative, but I guess for someone who's not really been...
Overall, it's extremely iterative, but it is one of those things where you step back and realize, like, over 15 years or whatever, a lot has changed.
Yeah, I agree. I pretty much agree with you. I kind of initially honestly felt that Black and White was a little redundant, in that that should have been when we saw a, you know, Generation 5 should have been this generation. But, you know, looking back on it now, I think what Generation 5 really did with Black and White was kind of refresh the palette. And I know that, not to make a pun on Palette Town, hey.
Hey-o!
But I remember you and I talking about it at the time, like, because when you got into the new world of Unova, there were, like, all these new Pokemon. You had no idea what types they were. it really made it feel like a new experience that I think that X and Y have benefited from. You know, we were kind of talking about with X and Y that it was really neat that the worldwide release meant that we were discovering a lot of stuff as we played instead of having all this game facts information.
Yeah, that was, to me, that has been something I've really enjoyed out of. In fact, a lot of the big Nintendo games the last few months have come out concurrently in Japan and the U.S., and I've really, really enjoyed the subsequent sort of, I don't know how you would say, but almost like a discovery curve, where we're on the front line as we're playing these games, learning about them. There are not guides or facts all over the internet. All of the secrets have not yet been spilled. And in Pokemon in particular, it was really exciting to not have a list of like, oh, this is where you catch this Pokemon.
Or even like, this is how this Pokemon evolves.
Yeah, yeah. I loved like having to tweet at people that I knew who were like, oh yeah, I just found an Eevee, and be like, oh girl, where did you find Eevee at? I haven't seen that yet. I really enjoyed that.
Exactly. Yeah, so I agree with you. I think that the iterative design has been really successful. My second question is, do you think that the franchise, and I mean, I want you to answer this personally and kind of also stepping outside of yourself, do you think that the franchise still has the same appeal today as it did 15 plus years ago?
I think it has a much higher level of appeal today than it did 15 years ago.
Oh, please elaborate.
You know, and you look at Pokemania and sort of the craze of Pokemania is gone, maybe. But I think that within the core gamer crowd, Pokemon was not as well-respected 15 years ago as it is now.
I agree.
Now, at the time, again, it looked like Pokemon could end at some point. Now, Pokemon looks to be the kind of series that as long as Nintendo treats the brand right, and you know they're going to, I don't really see an end.
Yeah.
As long as the game keeps good, I think it's just going to keep going in perpetuity at this point.
Yeah, and, you know, I agree that, you know, it's something that it does have a certain level of respect, and I think the fact that you can do wireless and that it's like, you know, just with the whole world, and like on a global scale, we're more connected. The fact that Pokemon games are more connected just really kind of really neatly coincided with the way that technology has evolved. So I think
yeah, absolutely.
That also increases the appeal. And my final question, or, you know, kind of just looking at your thoughts on the current state of the franchise and your predictions, hopes or fear when it comes to the future of the franchise.
You know, for the current state of the franchise, I want to say, like, as a media empire, I don't think Pokemon is as strong as it has been in the past. And I don't think, you know, I don't know that that's even in dispute. Like, I think that is almost kind of just a fact. But, in terms of from a game perspective, I think Pokemon as a game series now, like I was just saying, I think it is now stronger than it ever has been. I think it's well respected. I think every time there's a new iteration in the series, it's highly anticipated. I think that certainly these sales numbers just keep going up and up and up. Like, it's, I think in terms of sales, I think it's probably bigger now than it ever has been before as a game franchise. So, I think that the current state of the franchise is extremely healthy. My prediction for the future is that the game is, you know, the series is just going to grow. I think Nintendo is going to grow it carefully and, you know, just get it bigger and bigger and improve the quality with each iteration. As far as hopes and fears, I hope for more good games. I hope the third X and Y game probably will be Z. I think that would be superb. I can't wait to play it. And my only real fears are that, you know, they try to milk the cash cow too fast
yeah.
and don't give it the attention and time and respect that it deserves. But history tells us that will not be the case. Over 15 years, we're still only on, what, the sixth generation? It's pretty good, I'd say. It's a hell of a lot better than anyone else is managing their brands right now, I tell you what.
Yeah. Kind of looking forward to your predictions for the future. Kind of want you, if you were suddenly named the head of Game Freak, what would the next big step for you, gameplay-wise, design-wise, be for you?
I mean, you know, again, my I don't know how to answer that. Like,
I do think that there would be a real value in a console game, not entirely dissimilar to Gale of Darkness, but writ all large, except that's almost what X and Y was already.
Yeah, so like we said, the gap's kind of closing there.
So I couldn't really predict what comes next. That's, you know, I think that's part of why Pokemon is so incredible, is that they do keep taking steps beyond where we thought it would go, and it's still, once it gets there, it's like, oh yeah, of course that was the logical place for them to go next.
Yeah, it's hard for me to think of what could be bigger. I really would like to see, we haven't heard anything in terms of, like, DLC. I'd really like to think in the DLC era, digital distribution, etc., early Game Buoy episode, you know, I'd really like to see DLC missions, or, you know, kind of thinking of how Gold and Silver were such huge games. I would not mind paying, you know, $4.99 for a new gym, a new series of gyms that sprouted up on some islands or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's maybe the kind of the hope that I have, is that, you know, hopes for the future. My fear, which I don't think is likely, but the only fear I really have, is buy a Mewtwo, $7.99.
Yeah, that would be concerning. Although, again, you know, I have to say, I wouldn't be completely opposed to a Pokemon Emporium in-game where, for real money, maybe 99 cents, you could buy one Pokemon of your choice throughout, you know, the entire catalog. I mean, it sounds dirty, but if you really, really want to have a fucking Articuno in your box, maybe it would make sense for them to have that in there. They could make money off of it.
I think for, like, kind of the way that MMOsphere, things like that,
If they're level 1 and you have to raise them yourself from there, I don't see how there's an unfair advantage.
Perhaps, but, you know, if someone can't afford to have some Pokemon with better stats and a better moveset, that could have set them
out. Then they can breed it themselves.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that's very likely. I don't think...
Oh, heavens, I don't think it's likely, but if they had to go the microtransaction route, I think that Pokemon is uniquely suited, that since you could presumably still breed your own, it would just be a shortcut past the breeding aspect.
Yeah, and I mean, even especially if it's like, it won't guarantee your nature or anything.
See, I wouldn't even mind that, because again, you know, you can still breed it with hard work. I mean, you wouldn't be getting anything.
Yeah, you know, breed it and train it and raise it from its youngest level to champion.
You can just whore it out in every battle to get experience and grow it and train it the way you want.
I don't like you talking about Pokemon as whores, even though we do use them for our own pleasure. Anyway, I think you really kind of captured...
I battle Pokemon.
I really feel like I can't add too much to what you said, because I think you really summed it up. So, with that, let's go to our social links. Like we said yesterday, we caught up on the social links from last week. So today, why don't you share our social links from this week?
Well, our question of the week this week was, this week we're talking about Pokemon. What are your thoughts on how the franchise has developed over the years? Got a favorite game? And our Facebook bonus question was, between the TV show, movies, comics, toys, and trading card games, Pokemon has been one of the biggest multimedia franchises tied to the gaming industry. Have you ever bought into the gotta catch 'em all mentality outside of the games? And the Facebook bonus question, this is the last time you get to write all this out, you whore. Who's your favorite Pokemon?
How could I not ask that, though?
Because it's so obvious.
Well, and I'm going to ask you to answer it after you're done reading the social links.
I've already said it like 8 times in this episode.
Articuno?
Damn right, girl. My first Articuno was named Coma White after the Marilyn Manson song of the same name.
Oh, that's kind of badass.
So let's see. We have one here. We have a comment from Francisco Yu over on Facebook. In general, I say the series has gotten better. The core of the game has pretty much remained the same. You get your 3 starters, fire, water, and grass type, 8 gyms, an evil organization that you'll eventually dismantle, the Elite Four, and shorts. They're comfy and easy to wear.
Ah, love it.
Online features have improved a lot, and, well, it's as good as I can see Nintendo developing it in X and Y. I can't speak much for X and Y because I am still refusing to play until the Pokébox is released, and I can transfer Pokémon I specifically bred for this journey. Menu stuff has been streamlined from game to game. I don't miss how much of a hassle it was to check stats in Red and Blue. I do think a new system of organization for your items is in need. Your bag can get messy, and I'm like, where the fuck is that item I need? I also am happy how quickly the game saves in Pokémon X and Y. In Black and White 1 and 2, it felt like forever, even though realistically it wasn't too bad. My favorite game is Soul Silver. Bonus answer, I bought into the show, toys, and the whole card game. You bet your ass I went to Burger King to collect the toys promoting the first U.S. Pokémon movie. I saw the first movie 4 times to collect the special promo cards. In fact, I tried to specialize in collecting promo cards, but that shit got out of hand real quick, and I gave up with the rare limited to 50 only Kangaskhan. There was a time, too, that I almost dropped $150 for a Japanese Ancient Yu card. I participated in Pokemon Tour 2000 at the mall and got an official Mew with a certificate. There I saw the Pikachu Beetle and the Lugia PT Cruiser. I lost the first round in the gym battle thing they had on the tour as well. I have also bought a few plushies over the year. I kept my cards, but am not so much into Pokemon as this post might lead one to believe. Bonus answer, my favorite Pokemon is Dragonite. He's just so derpy, and aww. I have a tradition of using a Dratini as my starter.
Damn, Francisco, you work. And so the thing is that I have to say to that, Captain Spike, is that you think of me as the biggest Pokemaniac, and Francisco thinks that he's not even the biggest Pokemaniac, but I think he's more of a Pokemaniac than I am. Like, and it really just shows that people take this game super seriously. And I don't mean that in the LOL way. I think it's awesome.
No, they take it awesomely seriously because Pokemon is an effing
I mean, I remember
series.
Being part of a Pokemon online community back in the day in the early 2000s. And, you know, people were like, oh, well, this is your tank. This is your sweeper. You got your Parafusioner, Paralyzed and Confused. Like, there were, like, all these, like, you know, battle strategies and how to, you know, set up your team. And, you know, EV training, which now Super Training has let you simplify. But, you know, just people really, really get into, like, the deep strategy of this game that, you know, it's kind of deceiving how deep of strategy is involved if you want to take it to that place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's awesome. Thank you, Francisco.
Thank you, Francisco. Oh, actually, he's not done. He then asked us, I want to know if anyone gives nicknames to their Pokemon. I do, but only to the ones that stay as my main team during each Pokemon journey, or if I think of something clever. Like the Fletchling, I named Taylor Swift that has a naive nature and likes to run, not even making this up. He then posted a picture of the stat screen of this Fletchling, which confirms it does have the characteristic likes to run and the nature of naive. So yeah, Taylor Swift, dog.
Well done.
Yeah, that was effing incredible. And you know, I've talked here pretty much through this entire episode. I name all my Pokemon. If I'm gonna ever use it, I name it. Like, I'm not just gonna name some, like, bee drill I find because I hate bees. I'm not gonna take a bee drill with me. But, like, every one of my, like, starter Pokemon get names. Any, like, special Pokemon I catch get names. Any Pokemon I think looks super cute get names. I definitely name Pokemon.
I actually don't. And it's not that I dislike it. I guess, I never really think of good names, I don't know, but I typically don't.
Yeah, I love giving my Pokemon cute names.
That you do.
So yeah, we also had Colin over on the Facebook post that his favorite Pokemon was Eevee.
Aww.
So awesome, Eevee, yay!
Indeed.
Over on Twitter, we have Francisco Yu commenting, I'm so sorry for the lengthy comment I left on Facebook. Might as well get me as a guest this episode. Actually, we probably should.
Yeah, right?
And we have Deft Mike, or, I'm sorry, Act Deft, who said, I'll be definitely writing an email for this episode. Pokemon is one of my favorite franchises. As of this time, no such email has arrived in mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org's mailbox.
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org mailbox.
But we will keep our eyes peeled and include your email next week, Act Death.
Yeah. And
I want to take this moment to say,
please, 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 always, if you're listening to an archive of old Game Buoy episodes and you want to tweet at us about something that was said in any of them or any old questions of the week, please, 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 please feel free to join in and comment on that stuff. We'd still love to hear from you, even if you're talking about stuff that we said like a year ago. We'd still love to hear from you. It's not like Twitter or Facebook where, you know, you're stalking someone you think is hella fine and you accidentally favorite or like someone's post from a year ago.
Oh my god, that's the worst.
It's the worst. It's not like that for us. We love to hear what people have to say. We love that we have an archive of shows that we hope is listenable. Please take advantage and don't hesitate to reach out to us. With that, of course, I dare say I think it's time for us to start wrapping this show up. But as ever and always, we live for your feedback. We love your iTunes subscriptions and ratings/reviews.
We sure do.
We like your Facebook likes. We fucking love Twitter. You can tweet at us, of course, at gamebuoy.org with the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
D-O-T-O-R-G, gamebuoy.org.
You can also find us over on Tumblr.
Gamebuoy.tumblr.com.
As well as Google Plus.
GameBuoy.org over on Google Plus.
You can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org. And, of course, our home base can be found over at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Where you can find all of these social links, and much, much more.
Like our entire episode archive.
With that, it's time for our brief shout-outs.
Game Bar. Nerdgasm Network.
I wanna take it to a game bar!
Girls Gone Wow, Video Game Outsiders, Horde House, and the Nerd Podcast. Captain Spike?
I wanna shout out to Koopa Club, as always. They're very similar to what we do, and if you're not checking them out in addition to us, you're making a grave mistake. I also want to shout out to VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends. Both Koopa Club and VG Realness are LGBT-focused, and for that fact, so are we. So if you have a problem with that, fuck you. I also want to shout out to Geek Charisma, a podcast that is everything geek, with discussions on movies, DVDs, video games, conventions, and comics, as well as Neshoba talks with you about games. Also, please check out Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal basically all of my social cues.
He do.
Also, check out the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore, as well as the Retrograde podcast, where they take a look at some of the golden oldies and what makes them tick. Last but not least, I'd really, 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 really like to shout out to the video game Kickstarter that is Read Only Memories. This is a game that is being put together by the Gamer Connect and Gamer X folks over at their new game studio, Midboss Games. Is that?
Indeed, yes.
Brilliant. It looks like a modern take, or a less than modern take, in a really awesome retro throwback way to some of the classic Japanese adventure visual novels, Snatcher, Police Knots, and the like. They have a trailer up. I highly recommend you check it out. And if you can, throw them 6 bones for a donation. That's enough to get you a copy of the game, and I think that it will be definitely worth $6. Like, dude, that's not even like a Big Mac meal. With that having been said, our wonderful theme music for today was done by Pokemon Reorchestrated.
You heard that right, Pokemon Reorchestrated.
So go support them over on iTunes.
With that, we want to thank you for listening to us talk about Pokemon for 3+ hours. We love you out there on Radioland, and just thank you for sticking with us for 42 episodes, and we love you so much. So with that, keep gaming, keep thinking, and Ningo wo kakeru rakuto dan no futari ni wa hoaitu horu shiroi ashita ga maturaze nyante na!
So wait, when I do Japanese stuff, it's jank, but when you do whatever that was, it's okay?
was team...
No, you don't get to defend it. You get the last word when I do Japanese shit. I get it when you do. It is only fair.
Cause
Ruby.
I had a cause.
Ruby.
I had a Uranus.
Don't you know my ass is famous?
Dude.